You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Okay, howdy. Great. Welcome back from lunch. I hope everyone had a nice break. I'm going to introduce our keynote speaker for the day. Derek Kahn is here from, he is the Executive Associate Director at the Office of Management and Budget. He has a long history of working in the transportation industry and in policy. He was most recently Undersecretary of Transportation for Policy at the Department of Transportation, which he held almost for 2 years. He's also been the member of the board at the Board of Directors at Amtrak. He was a General Manager at Lyft, and then he had several other private sector experiences before that. Derek also worked in the Bush White House, where I knew him. He got his MBA at Stanford, GSB, where he was an R.J. Miller scholar. I can tell you, I was co-teaching a class when I was getting my PhD at Stanford about more than 2 decades ago. And the R.J. Miller scholars are the top 10% of the class. And I can tell you that I wish everybody was in that top 10%. Of course, mathematically, that's not possible, but they were the best students. You get that award for the highest GPA in the class, and it was really a joy to teach them. He also has a degree in economics from LSE, and he graduated from USC. So without further ado, here is Derek Kahn to talk about autonomous vehicles and the topics of this conference. Thank you.
Thanks, Karuk, and thank you all for being here. Nothing like a post-lunch fascinating conversation, so hopefully the blood is flowing from your brain to your stomach, and we'll see who stays awake in 45 minutes. So I wanted to thank you for the kind introduction. It's great to be here at Brookings. There's a lot of familiar faces in the room. You had a great presentation this morning from Ken Leonard, who leads a lot of the work at DOT. And the afternoon is much more exciting. I wish I could stay because the next panel is fascinating with some of the foremost experts around P3s. You have Rick Geddes, who literally is the nation's top experts in public-private partnerships. Marju Blumenthal has perhaps the best, most comprehensive analysis. She wrote at RAND on a safety framework. And Cliff Winston has this really creative, fascinating paper on why traffic deaths drop during recessions. And it's really, in short, a self-selection process is sort of what he predicts, but just a great set of panels. And at the end of the day, you have Tanya Snyder chairing a panel, and Tanya's great. She's a reporter at Politico. She always asks very insightful and provocative questions. I'm thankful she's not going to be able to ask me any, I hope. So I wanted to do a few things this morning. I wanted to share some broad observations on mobility and broad trends. Then I wanted to talk about broad observations around autonomous vehicles, what the federal government is doing for mobility and AVs, and end with just a lightning round of big questions that folks are asking and my short answers. In terms of broad observations on mobility and autonomous vehicle, we see a mega trend around mass urbanization. Data shows that about 55% of the world currently lives in major metropolitan cities. By 2050, that's expected to grow to 66%. Consequently, urban congestion will be the greatest challenge for the next generation. And you not only see mass urbanization growing, but also the concept of mobility and the concept of the car is changing. One of the megatrends around the car is they expect cars of the future to be three things: shared, connected, and electrified. And I think there's jury still out on some of these, but shared, certainly the case. Connected, a lot of the panelists this morning talked about the importance of connected vehicles, and it seems like there are demonstrated safety benefits. And electric, I think that one has some open discussion and sort of open debate if we see that. We're also seeing with mobility a much greater understanding and insight into travel patterns like we've never seen before. If you look at how people travel, most recent data from the Federal Highway shows that people travel patterns follow a Poisson distribution. 70% of the trips you take are 10 miles or less. And once upon a time, you had three modes of transportation: mass transit, car or train. Well, then the airplane came along, and that sort of was the three or four main travel modalities. However, today you have e-bikes, you have scooters, and what you're seeing is for these 70% of trips, there's going to be a whole set of options that you've never seen before. And on top of that, with companies like Uber, Lyft, and Didi, and all of these ride-sharing companies, we now have an app that can help us make the trade-off between time, distance, and price, which is something we've never had before. And as a result, the way we travel is changing rapidly. Also, people tend to think that transportation will move slowly and evolve slowly. That's not completely true if you look at history. In 1900, there were about 8,000 cars in the United States. 20 years later, in 1920, there were 8 million cars in the United States, a 1,000-fold increase. And from 8 million cars in 1920, today you have about 270 million cars. And so the first 20 years of a new technology, you see radical transformation. And today we have more cars than we do adults over the age of 18. Part of this fascinating expansion in the early 1900s was the creation of the car dealership. And I'll touch on that briefly, but from 1900 to 1920, tens of thousands of car dealerships grew across the country. And as we start thinking about the autonomous vehicle, there's a core policy question of this important constituency, car dealerships, what will be the future of them? We're also seeing new business models that didn't exist a year ago, from ride-sharing scooters to e-bikes. And as we think about new business models, dealerships are going to play an important role. Two other sort of macro trends here. There's significant regional variation as you look at automobiles generally. Detroit, when it was first conceived, was the perfect mix of talent and supply chain. It was where a lot of railroads crossed it, so it was easy to get auto parts into that region. And suddenly you had automakers, parts suppliers, transportation hubs, what we in Silicon Valley called the ecosystem. You had a perfect ecosystem to distribute this innovative technology at the turn of the 20th century. However, in the last few years, we've started to see a massive shift away from Detroit to the south in states like Alabama, Kentucky, and Tennessee. And so today, Alabama is one of the largest manufacturers of autos because of things like tax incentives, a robust ecosystem of talent and suppliers, and close proximity to a supply chain, namely ports and transportation hubs. And so this raises an important question, I think, for policymakers, for researchers. Where will the first 10,000 autonomous vehicles be produced in this country? Or maybe around the world? In what country will you see the first 10,000 vehicles? And in what state will you see these first vehicles? Will it be in Silicon Valley, where technologists, computer scientists, and sensor experts live? Or will it be in a manufacturing hub, where low cost of labor, auto parts manufacturers persist? Finally, one broad observation, global competitiveness. Right now, the United States has perhaps the greatest capacity for innovation. And I think what we're going to see in the next 10 years is which country will lead around autonomous vehicles. Right now, there are really three broad models in terms of national regulation. You have the Chinese model, which is a very unitary, centrally planned model, where they have, for the next 15 years, layout of what milestones they hope to hit in terms of cars produced, tech milestones. They literally have a national product roadmap for the introduction of the electric vehicle and the autonomous vehicle. You have Europe that has a council. In Germany, they have a council, and I think it's called the Golden Council, that together, this council made up of stakeholders, of unions, of car manufacturers, together set policy. And then you have the United States, which is very open. We have federal voluntary policy, some state policy, but for the most part, a very open, let a thousand flower blooms approach and see what emerges. The fascinating thing is going to be over the next decade, which of these three models will emerge? And I have a point of view that I'll share at the end. But it's an important question as we as policymakers think, what does the competitive landscape of this look like? Some broad observations on autonomous vehicles. Every 5-10 years, people have a look forward of what AVs will look like. And I think people love predicting the future of AVs and have we hit the milestones. In short, we've gotten some things right, some things wrong, and a lot of things we don't know. What did we get right? We knew that the technology would be very difficult, We knew that partnerships between OEMs and technology would be important. And we had some interesting theoretical observations very early on in the process. For instance, the introduction of automation and AI taught us that autonomous vehicles actually do something very different with the concept of risk. And Karak has a great paper called Driverless Cars on the concept of risk. Autonomous vehicles didn't diffuse risk. It actually centralized risk. It centralized risk with the engineers. And so instead of those of us in this room potentially getting a car accident, what we did is we resulted in a single computer engineer potentially putting into a line of code a major incident that everybody in the room would suffer if their car was in a similar situation. And so that was an early observation that theorists had, and it's helpful in some ways and something we need to be mindful of as we move forward. I think some other things we got right, two more. One is partnerships are key. The Department of Transportation recently put out autonomous vehicle demonstration grants, and if you look at these grants, they're designed to have people apply as partners. And we're realizing that no single entity, no city, no OEM, no technology company can do the entire stack. Rather, you need a partnership that manages hardware, software, customer, all of these things together is going to enable the autonomous vehicle to come to market. And finally, we also got right, I think, that the city, state, and federal roles will be very different. And I think for the most part, these are largely agreed upon. They're not settled matters, but they're largely agreed upon. The federal government's role is to oversee the engineering and the design of the vehicle. The state's responsibility is around the operation of the vehicle, so speed limits, things like what is considered safe and unsafe behavior, and insurance, which has largely been delegated to states throughout our nation's history. We got a lot of things wrong, though, too, at the same time. We got wrong things like timing. We assumed that products would come to market much faster. Every 5 years, a forecast says in 4 years this will happen. We've actually seen it with all the OEMs. And literally every prediction of when cars will be on the road have been missed. 10 years ago, we thought there'd be thousands of autonomous vehicles deployed in the country today. That certainly hasn't been the case. Today, there are 1,400 vehicles all being tested in the United States, but none that are being sold for commercial purposes. Number two, what we got wrong were metrics to evaluate success. And I hope this afternoon the people in this room can really help us with this question. It's a very complicated policy question. But if you recall, when autonomous vehicles first hit the road, there were two main metrics people loved talking about. Maybe three, but two main ones. Number one, vehicle miles tested. Who's tested the most miles? Who's hit 1 billion miles? Who's hit 2 billion miles? Who's hit the most miles tested? Number two was disengagements. How often did a safety driver have to take over the car? Disengagements, miles tested were the two metrics that some states asked autonomous vehicles to report on. Now, we've learned over the last few years that both these metrics, while helpful to advance the dialogue, create major principal agent problems. Vehicle miles tested is a very, very blunt test. Think about it. If you drive 50,000 miles across the coast in between, that's a very different test scenario than 50,000 miles inside a major metropolitan area. In some parts of the country, you could drive 1,000 miles without seeing another person, another car. And so this whole concept of vehicle miles tested, we sort of look back and say, like, yeah, that probably wasn't the best metric to lead off on. The second also created major challenges and took us a little bit for a curveball. That was disengagements. All cars today have, or vast majority of cars today have a safety driver. So if you're driving in a vehicle and there's a problem, safety driver takes over, takes control of the vehicle. Some states, City of San Francisco, State of California, I believe, wanted people to report on the number of disengagements. Well, the problem with disengagements is it's a gameable metric. And this is one of the points that Margie puts out in the RAND paper that you'll probably hear about in the next panel. But if you can game a metric, if you could game a safety metric, it's not a very good metric. And so as policymakers, it's something we spend a lot of time thinking about. what are reasonable metrics, non-gameable metrics? And we actually see it's not simply an autonomous vehicle problem. It's a problem that exists throughout all transportation. For instance, dangerous driving. We know the consequence of dangerous driving has a clear red line, which is a fatal car accident. But preceding to that, what are other examples of dangerous driving? We have proxies for, but if it doesn't lead to a fatal accident, was that really dangerous or not? And so you get into these challenges of what are good proxies for safety, knowing the outer bounds of safety are accidents and the outer bound are fatal car accidents. So one of the things we got wrong very early on were metrics to evaluate success. And it's not anything wrong, I mean, in the evolution of policy. It's where you'd expect us to be. I think one other thing that we are moving away from are the SAE 5 levels framework. We talk a lot about level 3, 4, and 5, and we've realized that level 3 is an important, it's a useful framework for the starting point, but level 3 is a very broad bucket with a lot of examples, and we're starting to figure out how do we parse level 3 SAE testing. What we still don't know, I think there are two big things we still don't know. One, what are the metrics we use to evaluate success? And this is so important. I truly hope that the people in this room can help us think about this question and think through what should the metrics be that the federal government uses, that the state government uses to measure success. And number two, what is the sensor stack? That's a technology problem, but a very serious one. There really are two big heuristics that exist in this day and age. One is the autonomous vehicle replicates two core human functions, core human cognitive functions, the ability to see and the ability to think. And the theory goes, if the ability to see is what the autonomous vehicle is trying to replicate, then all we need are cars. We don't have internal radar. We don't have internal sonar. We just have two eyes in which we can see. And so the concept is, let's have only cameras, not LIDAR. And not radar, and not all these other things, simply a camera. The other sort of end of the spectrum is all of these things are important. We actually do have depth perception, which is radar. We do have the ability to see how fast things are moving, which is LIDAR. And so to replicate the eye, you can't simply use cameras. You need a comprehensive sensor stack of LIDAR, radar, cameras. This is an important business decision because it really gets to who is going to win in the hardware space and starts getting to regulation and policy. To what extent should policymakers say this is what your technology stack needs to look like? We still don't know what the stack looks like. We don't know how to measure that sensor stack. And we really don't know yet how safe is safe enough. Our hope is that where we are as a nation, though, is at a good place, and I think it is. We currently have 1,400 vehicles in the United States being tested by, I think, over 70-some different companies, and I think Ken Leonard in the back has all of the numbers chapter and verse. And in California alone, we have 1,200 vehicles being tested. I want to spend last few minutes talking about policy broadly, what the administration's doing, and conclude with a lightning round of major open questions. The administration has laid down broad principles on autonomous vehicles, and it touches and builds upon the earlier part of my talk. Number one, prioritize safety. No matter how exciting this is, no matter how many lives we can save, no matter how many people in this room can sleep in the back seat of an autonomous vehicle like they are right now, you know, it can satisfy, safety must come first. Number two, tech neutral. Federal government nor any government, in our opinion, should be saying that this is the ideal technology stack. So we call that tech neutral. We don't know if one form of LIDAR, a solid-state LIDAR, is better than a non-solid-state LIDAR. We don't know if a LIDAR is better than a radar. Rather, what we want to move toward is a performance-based policy or performance-based regulation versus something on the front end where we lay out specific detailed approaches in terms of the inputs. So prioritize safety, tech neutral. We also are not top-down command and control, but rather our approach has been to modernize regulations. if you look at regulations, particularly the federal motor vehicle safety standards, there's four different chapters. The second chapter of FMVSS is called crash worthiness standards. The 200s are generally crash worthiness standards. In the case of an automobile accident, what are the internal components and design standards of a car that reduces the impact and ensures the safety of the people inside the car? Well, as policymakers, an interesting policy question came before us when I was at DOT. What if this car is designed to never have a person? What if it will never, ever transport a human being, not as a driver, not as a passenger? Do we need to put in airbags, windshield wipers, mirrors? Well, there's one company in this country designing self-driving package delivery vehicle that says FMVSS, Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, requires these things. So we have a seatbelt in it. We have an airbag in our prototype. And I sit and think, like, where's your airbag place? Like, who are you protecting? And so this is a perfect example of how we need, as a federal government, to modernize our regulations. At DOT, we've looked at all the activities around autonomous vehicles in three big buckets: regulations, research, and public awareness. On the regulations front, we've streamlined the exemption process, how you can apply to produce more autonomous vehicles for sale. We've begun to update and modernize standards around federal motor vehicle safety standards. And what that means is systematically going through every rule we have to better understand, is it applicable for an era in the concept of things like package delivery? And some are easy. Some are very easy up front. For instance, does the steering wheel need to be designed a certain way in terms of the radius of the steering wheel if you don't have anybody behind it? And so that's one clear example where we probably don't need things like a steering wheel and brake pads. But then there are other parts of the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards that raise other questions, such as in case of crash avoidance, how prescriptive should the federal government be in laying down specific engineering rules as to how self-driving cars can avoid accidents? So the streamlining, the exemption process is easy. Modernizing standards and FMVSS is a little hard. Some are easy, some are hard. Two other fronts we're spending a lot of time on is on research. This administration has put out two autonomous vehicle voluntary guidance. Secretary Chao, when she came into office, was very eager to make sure that the federal government would not be an impediment to the adoption of autonomous vehicles, but rather that would be left to the public sector, to the public, and that the only real constraint of adoption should be a willingness of the people in this room to get in the back of it. We did not want the federal government to be the constraint here. Also on research, we've done things like incorporated new technologies into our discretionary grants, and we've even begun to do things like develop crash dummies for rear-facing seats and researching alternative occupant protection systems. So that's regulations, that's research. The final one we've spent a lot of time doing is on public awareness. Campaigns like this, conferences like this are great because the policy questions are complicated. And so we've done a number of listening sessions and a number of events around the country highlighting good research, innovation, and also the policy questions that exist. And so at a high level, what DOT has done in the 2.5 years under Secretary Chao and President Trump is transformed itself as an organization. For better part of 50 years, we were focused on existing transportation modes. However, we've moved from basic existing transportation sources to new technologies. And it's been a cultural change like you've never seen. That as we look at everything from discretionary grants to activities around the country, we'll ask ourselves, how do we imbue and embed technology into this? And it's a long road, but the department is well positioned to embrace this. We also see this shift and this embrace of technology on the Hill. Last year, Congress appropriated $100 million for autonomous vehicle demonstration grants. And right now there's talk of, should we enact an AV Start bill, which deals with federal preemption and allocation of liability in this space. I want to end in our last few minutes with a few big questions and sort of lightning round it and conclude. I see six big questions that folks like asking about. Number one, where does regulation go from here? I expect regulation to have a lot of stops and starts. I expect federal government to put out more RFIs, maybe even a proposed rule, get a lot of comments back, and we'll stop and analyze it for a while. I expect states to do the same. I expect some states to go out very quick. Something happens, and they pull back. We see that in Phoenix right now. Number two, when will AVs launch? Question everybody always has. Hard to say, but my guess is much longer than people think. A lot of people are predicting in the next few years. My personal sense is it's going to be a few years, 5 years or longer, before we see autonomous vehicles commercially viable for the broad public. Number three, what will the role of infrastructure be? And I know that's a key part of today's conversation. My sense is infrastructure is one of many variables in determining what region wins, what country wins. And what I mean by that is infrastructure, V2V, V2I technology is potentially important, but not all car companies believe it's a prerequisite to success. Rather, it's going to be one of many variables, such as state and local laws, such as the ecosystem I talked about earlier, customer acceptance and public perception, and how you will have fixed and zoned routes. So infrastructure will be important, but I don't think it will be the driving exogenous factor. Number four, how will liability be sorted out? And I think it's an important question. We're starting to see the development of insurance products for ride-sharing companies. I expect the same to happen with autonomous vehicles. And so how will liability be sorted out? I think through the market and through the creation of new products, and then finally through the courts. There's no clear federal role for insurance, as it's generally regulated at the state level. So I see states starting to think about how they assign liability. And right now the model people frequently point to is the aviation model. How will locals respond, and what will it look like around the country? I think there will be a patchwork for a long period of time with local governments learning from each other. And you're starting to see that now with ride-sharing, and right now you're seeing with scooters. Some cities are very, very much embracing scooters. Others are setting quotas on scooters. Others are setting licenses. And so we see cities having a very different approach and then evolving into cities teaching each other what they've learned. And we're seeing it now with airports. For anybody that travels to an airport in a ride-sharing car, you're now taxed often at the airport, and that airport revenue is used to make up for parking lot revenue. And this was not this was not sort of a centrally planned thing, just a few airports had this creative insight, inelastic demand of going to an airport in a rideshare. $2 isn't going to make or break it. And so you're starting to see cities across, municipal airports across the country embrace this. I expect the same with autonomous vehicles, that there's also a major, massive business opportunity here. Helping cities develop the platform and tools to manage new mobility options is going to be something major and something significant that you will see one day there to be the Google platform of all mobility options in cities. And finally, who will win globally? My sense is Asia will likely win in the near term. There are the next 3, 4, 5 years, we're going to see China just start producing more and more autonomous vehicles. But I believe in the long term, the United States will win, just because there are parts of the technology stack that are probably incorrect that we're not even thinking about today. Just like the cell phone, when the cell phone first came out, and which was about 11 and a half years ago, the camera being a part of it was strange. Why do we need a camera in our pocket all the time? But now, as we go out, I'm going to be taking a selfie with all of you, so clearly it's just such a critical element of our life. I want to just conclude by saying this is an exciting time, and this is just a time in which there is so much hope and excitement around autonomous vehicles, and there are so many eyeballs on this new technology. And the excitement and the hype in AVs is shared by the administration, by the department. But underneath all of this excitement, there's a huge body of work being done. There's coding done by computer scientists. There's the muscle of automotive engineers putting components onto cars. There's hardware engineers thinking of what the next graphics processing unit should look like, the grit of infrastructure builders, and the insight of policymakers. And I think half this room is made up of policymakers. And this is where a lot of the hard work will be done. believe it or not, the papers you put together, the paper that Rand put together, was such an important piece of work. The driverless cars piece that Kuroke wrote in December, so helpful in shaping the views of policymakers. So for those of you in this room that are sitting here listening and thinking about how AVs play out, I welcome and encourage you to keep being part of the dialogue, because it's through the notice and comment, through the request for information, that you inform policymakers about what AV 4.0 should look like, what the next set of AV rules should look like. And so that help is so important to all that we do. I spend a lot of time today predicting and sort of sharing a forecast of what the future's like. In the words of Yogi Berra, prediction is hard, especially about the future. So take it for what it's worth. And with that, I want to thank you all for being here, for being part of this great conversation, and I'll open up for Q&A.
Thank you for your comments. It's very helpful. I know you had said earlier that you felt that infrastructure is not going to be the driver for AVs, but I think it's safe to assume that most AVs are going to be EVs. And so with that, given that there is money in the public space, particularly through states, to spend money on EV infrastructure, and I know that there has been some hesitation on spending some of that money because states are very concerned about, I want to spend this money smart. I don't want to spend it for something that's good for 3 years. I want to think about the next 5, 10, or 20 years with respect to how to spend this money. And on top of that, we know that Senator Carper has proposed a highway corridor bill, which could introduce additional monies, particularly along the highway corridor, to support this. So with that in mind, the highway corridor bill, VW settlement, a lot of this money is in state hands. What should they be thinking about today to spend that money wisely and be able to enable technology that we want to see in the near future?
It's a question was, how should cities and states think about all of this money that we're seeing in infrastructure from the Surface Transportation Reauthorization Bill? Earlier this week, Senator Carper, Senator Barrasso, chairman of the and ranking member of the Environmental Public Works, released a bill. The bill was about $297 billion over 5 years in increased infrastructure spending. I don't think infrastructure is going to be an enabler, but I do think infrastructure has the potential to be a blocker. If you look online, you'll find a lot of pictures of situations where self-driving cars are unable to drive in because the infrastructure just doesn't make sense. So while the right infrastructure will not bring AVs to your cities or states, the wrong infrastructure will deter you. So I do think that you're going to see from the Department of Transportation, from Congress, an expansion of how surface transportation programs operate. And just in general, the way surface transportation programs operate, it is they are federally funded, state administered. And so the federal government takes the money from the gas tax, gives it to states, and there is a broad set of eligibilities that state can use this money on. States are seeing increased eligibility for things like technology and electric vehicles. That was passed in the last Surface Transportation Reauthorization Bill called the FAST Act. Also, there's a number of discretionary grants that the federal government has, and we've incorporated technology into it. So the way I would think about it as cities and states is this Department of Transportation, this administration, is very eager and open to new technologies and innovation. And so if you look at the discretionary grants that DOT put out, technology was an important element. So what I would encourage cities and states to do is to think through how can you infuse AVs, new technologies, innovation, EVs, into the thinking of applying for state and federal funds. Because it's definitely something that federal government looks at, and it's something that is an increased eligibility. What will be interesting over the next 6 months is not only did we expand eligibility, but are you going to see a shift in criteria where there's actually emphasis placed upon EV infrastructure or AVs? My general sense is part of our tech neutrality is while industry seems to be pursuing electric vehicles and autonomous vehicles, this administration does not take that as a given. And so if there's going to be an AV with a combustion engine, we're not going to say that doesn't make sense. Rather, we are tech neutral, particularly as it pertains to EVs and combustion engine.
Thank you very much. My question is that the automobile vehicles cost to everyday life for everyday citizens. I'm not sure that anybody mentioned about that subject. Particularly, I'm concerned, like automated street. You have to pay 1 mile how much. Probably it won't happen too soon, but if it happened in everywhere, I wonder that maybe somebody has to think about it. Something like a food stamp, something like a road stamp for low-income people.
Question was, how do we think about AVs to specific populations like low-income and populations that have greater needs? Well, I could share with you, the Department of Transportation was given $100 million, and it's actually presented a very complicated policy question. In a space where there's billions of dollars, federal government gave us $100 million to allocate it. Well, there literally is billions of dollars from venture capitalists to OEMs. So the way we looked at this pot of money is, where is there a lack of investment? Where is there a market failure in the sense of not enough research going into a particular area? The specific area in which we invested it were in populations with the elderly and the disabled. And we thought that most AV companies are not going to go out and think, how do we serve low-income populations or populations with people with disabilities? Rather, we as a federal government, as an administration, said this is probably going to be an area where you don't see a ton of fruitful research. And so we designed a lot of our research agenda around this particular question: how will AVs serve this population? And on this front, and this is sort of going back to my experience before government, the amazing thing about ride-sharing companies and autonomous vehicle technology is it is a great tool for certain populations, such as the elderly, such as those that are in need, as the questioner asked, because we can deliver transportation to your phone and tell you, please go outside right now to catch a self-driving car that's going to come and find you. And so what you see is this technology has so much potential to really transform the lives of people. It's just, are we going to have enough investment and focus on it? We as a government, as an administration, are trying to answer this exact question and make sure there is enough research done to what everything from the human design of the car should look like to how will we ensure that all populations will have access to these vehicles.
So one of the things that you brought up was the importance of states and localities. And following on the prior question, if you are blind or unable to drive, you literally can't sit in the driver's seat, even if it's a self-driving car. The Uniform Laws Commission did just complete, after 2 years, a model for states to overcome these types of legacy problems. To what extent do you see the administration's ability to help normalize state laws across the country with respect to enabling access and mobility?
Great question. What is the federal government doing to help mobilize state patchwork of laws around mobility, particularly for specific populations? We try to find, this administration's philosophy is we want to find that right balance from identifying good practices without being heavy-handed and telling all states to do something, particularly when it's not entirely clear to us that there is a federal role as set in the Constitution. And so if you look at AV 3.0, the guidance Secretary Chao put out last September of 2018, we actually lay out model or best practices at the state level. And in that section, we talk about specific populations. And I expect at some point in time over the next 2 years, we'll update that and say, here are what we're seeing among states, and here are the best practices, some of the best legislation we're seeing in states, And we recommend that other states start thinking about these things. And so what we've done is we've tried to pull up at the federal level all the things states are doing and put together resources that we can then distribute to other state legislators. Our view is not to be command and control, in large part because populations in every city and state are different. So it's somewhat presumptuous for us to believe that there's a one-size-fits-all approach, particularly when it comes to particular populations, because that's not just population, but it's also what does the city look like, how is the city designed. And these are things we clearly recognize as authorities delegated to the states. However, we believe there's an important federal role in identifying the best practices, model legislation or best practice legislation, and then circulating that and sharing that with state DOT heads and state governors.
So there's no legislative framework for autonomous vehicles. There are no federal regulatory requirements. It's all voluntary. And Tesla is saying that they're going to have released kind of a software update within this year to have fully self-driving cars. Already they have autopilot on the highways. They're saying that they're going to have the capability to do the same in urban areas. That's making a lot of people very anxious, but what is the federal government's ability or interest in setting some guardrails around that?
Great question. The question was, there are no federal laws or regulations around this. What is the federal government's role going to be when companies claim or pronounce they're going to put cars on the road soon? So that first part of your question is actually somewhat of a misconception. The federal government does have tremendous authorities. We have something called defect authority, and we have the ability to direct automakers to cease and desist. So defect authority is a very powerful authority that NHTSA has. If there is a component of a car that is defective, we could pull cars off the road. And our interpretation of our defect authority is that this applies to the algorithm, the AI, the brains of autonomous vehicle. And we describe this in AV 3.0 in our voluntary guidance, that we have all of the authorities we need, that if we see bad actors, if we see cars not doing what they're programmed or what they're marketed to do, we will take those cars off the road. And in fact, we have. In Florida, there was one AV shuttle provider that had claimed they were testing this AV shuttle. Well, it came to the department's attention that they were transporting children to and from school or around the city. And so in our mind, that is clearly not testing. That's actually deployment of technology. And so we order them to stop all testing. And so the concept that we aren't doing anything is a bit of a misnomer, but we actually are monitoring vigorously what is happening across the country. And NHTSA's defect authority is an extremely powerful authority where we could take any set of cars off the road. The hard part is this, as policymakers, is when there are cases in which it's a combination of poor user error and poor design, and it's not entirely clear where their problem is. And that's oftentimes where the gray area becomes. Should we more aggressively use defect authority or not? And so Tesla is going to be one example where we are going to be tracking the deployment of Tesla's very closely and seeing how that plays out. But there are federal laws. There is a federal law that has been on the books for decades that empowers NHTSA to identify any defects and take cars off the road. I saw one last question, and then maybe we'll turn over to the next panel.
Thank you. You said that autonomous vehicles replicate our ability to see and think. And I would argue that they also will hear and remember. So hear and remember. And so I think that in the priorities that you listed, I didn't hear data privacy and security issues as one of them. And I understand that there are a lot of people currently claiming jurisdiction over those issues. And it is not necessarily a place where DOT has had to tread. But at what point do you see DOT needing to engage with data privacy and security issues when you're engaging with this new technology? I realize I'm asking for another prediction, but
yeah. Question was, how does DOT think about data privacy? Because one of the one of the components of what cars do is not only see and think, but also hear and remember. And that's absolutely true. The reason self-driving cars are getting better is because they have an algorithm that learns from the past, similar to how we drive. The role of data privacy is a very open question, which has tons of different views. I have a personal view and sense of where things are going, but it's very informed because there are two major issues here. One is there's not a clear legal authority for DOT to acquire, regulate, track, mandate any type of data standard. And that presents a complexity here. There are pieces of law we can interpret, such as different types of authorities we can interpret broadly, but there's not been any clear direction from Congress what the desire is for DOT to do or any federal agency to do around data privacy. However, there's a very good model out there. It's called the ASIAS model, A-S-I-A-S. It's a great model. People should look. After, I forget if it was 93 or 94, there was a summer in which there were a number of significant passenger plane accidents in this country. That ValueJet was one of them, and the Everglades, New York, had a second one. And what air carriers did is they came together and said, you know what, we should figure out a way to share information in a way that we don't trip any anti-competitive laws, we protect our trade secrets, and we don't get into trouble with these things. And so they created a system called ASIAS, where twice a year for, I think, 2 days, the top operators from air carriers share data. I was landing at JFK, and my warning indicator started beeping. I don't know why. Another person in the room says the same thing happened to me. And suddenly, through pattern recognition, different air carriers with different pilots start pattern recognizing and understanding some of the problems they ran into. This is not there's no congressional mandate. There's no legal requirement to do this. But what Congress did do is it passed an indemnity provision that said if you share data for public good or public safety for this specific program, you're indemnified from prosecution, provided it wasn't intentional and provided you report within 24 hours. So there's basically a voluntary data sharing organization that came about. And I think this is going to be one of the important ways that this is addressed, that as AV automakers start coming together and sharing data, that'll address some of it. But it doesn't address the other side of that coin, which is personal data. And that's one that there are tons of different views. My personal prediction for this, again, channeling Yogi Berra, take it for what it's worth, is I think you will see Europe much more aggressively thinking about this than the United States. With GDPR, you're already seeing questions around data, around what tech firms are tracking. And so what that tells me is you're going to see other countries move faster on this data privacy piece, I think, than we are, simply because that's an issue that they think a lot about. Whereas here it's unclear, is this a state issue? Is it a federal issue? Where would we derive our legal authority from? And what are the mandates that we'd put on them? So what I see in this country, at least, there have been two moderate attempts to create a voluntary data exchange. The problem with that is when you have companies that are at very different life stages, pure startup to companies that have invested $50 billion, there is no desire to share data. And so what we're seeing with some of the researchers, some of the panelists you're going to talk to next, is what should they even be tracking? And my hope is before we get into even privacy, we begin to just align on what is the specific safety standards we want data to report on, and let's start sharing those things before we start getting into the very sticky wicket of insurance, of data privacy, and data sharing. So with that, I very much appreciate Karel and Brookings for hosting this fascinating discussion. I hope you all stick around for the next two panels and really appreciate your engagement on this issue. It's really active citizens, engineers, policymakers that together are going to help shape this technology that our kids will look back at and say it transformed the world. So thank you very much. Really appreciate the time.
Okay, thank you. So we're going to move forward with our next panel on policy. This will be a little different from our morning sessions. So that timer is something I should get. Next time I get into an argument with my wife, I'm going to bring that. So we're going to have more of a open-ended kind of broader conversation about policy. I would like to try to connect our conversation to everything we've done so far this morning, the technical topics as well as the keynote. So we're going to try to have as much of an open conversation as we can, and to address many of the issues that have come up. Again, just a level set. I think this is. I think we're all on the same page. We want to understand how this technology can eventually develop, and I think it is a big challenge that will require the coordination or at least the cooperation of multiple different parties. To me, this area is wide open. There's still, we're in the very early innings of the game, and as a community, I think we need to think through how exactly this will work out. With both private sector, public sector, and everyone in between. So let me introduce our panelists who will speak about these issues. What I'll do is I'll do a quick intro. They'll kind of do a longer intro on themselves. It's always optimal that way. And then they will give them a little bit of an opening statement to talk for a few minutes about their thoughts broadly on this topic. And then beyond that, I'll go into some leading questions. And if the discussion is not conversational enough, I'll try to be more provocative. Okay, so first I'd like to introduce Cliff Winston. Cliff has been at Brookings since 1984. He was at one point the editor of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity. Also in a prior life, he was associate professor at MIT in civil engineering. He has a lot of writing on autonomous vehicles and also on privatization and deregulation. He's had many books and essays with colorful titles like Let's Deregulate All the Lawyers. He has a PhD from UC Berkeley, just like everyone on the A&M infrastructure panel. Okay. I'd also like to introduce Cliff. Oh, sorry, I just did Cliff. Rick. Rick is a professor of policy analysis and management at Cornell. He's the founding director of the Cornell Program in Infrastructure Policy, CPIP. So he is a real expert on infrastructure policy. He was at the Council of Economic Advisors 3 years before I was, so 2004 to 2005. And he has a PhD from my favorite university, University of Chicago. Second favorite, A&M is my favorite now. Marjorie is a senior policy researcher at RAND. She has worked at the Office of Science and Technology Policy, and she was also an associate provost at Georgetown. She has written extensively on autonomous vehicle safety and policy and has an MPP from Harvard. So sorry to repeat the credentials. It must be my Indian-American upbringing to constantly think about my credentials. That's how I was raised. So that's all I'm going to say up front, and then I'm going to sit down, and then why don't we just go sequentially from left to right on my side, just to talk a little bit about, say a few more remarks about yourself and about your views on autonomous vehicles, and then we'll get more specific. Does that work?
5 minutes, right?
Yeah, 5 minutes is fine, yeah. Do you want to go, Cliff?
Oh,
yeah. It's been a while. Two articles were in Sunday on autonomous vehicles in the paper. I'll go through those briefly to frame my comments. It's not to point out it was fake news, to point out it was incomplete news, which I'll fill in from the perspective of transportation economics. First one was in the Times, and it was one of these ones that says we're not going to get autonomous vehicles tomorrow. They'll be long off. What was really missing in that piece was some historical perspective. It really would have been helpful to mention the airline industry. 1920s, even though the industry was going, there were many people who did not think we would ever have a commercially viable airline industry. Even in the 30s, when the industry was moving along, people said, aircraft technology has peaked. We're not going to see better planes than what we've got now. Obviously, they were wrong. Same kind of problems are going to exist with autonomous vehicles. What would have also been helpful is to point out the development of the airline industry was not hampered by its own progress, but by the government. We learned that very quickly when we had regulation and deregulation in the 70s. We saw what that did, constraining pricing, entry, exit, so on and so forth. And remarkably, it exists today. We still don't have open skies on all our routes. And most importantly, we don't have cabotage. Foreign carriers cannot serve our routes. That'd be handy now, given that Boeing is grounded its 737 MAX. All that could have been filled in with foreign carriers. Other problem is infrastructure. Still got public airports. Still got public air traffic control. You can't get any more efficient than either of, inefficient than either of those, and those have hurt the industry. Second article was in the Post, also on Sunday. That was one. What are the failures we've learned about autos that we can, you know, learn, try to improve autonomous vehicles? Maybe you saw that article. I didn't get any of the failures out of there. I couldn't figure out what they were talking about. New Yorker has a similar one, equally bad. It's very obvious what the failures were. Again, all from highway policy. All the inefficiencies that have compromised automobile travel are going to make autonomous vehicle travel even worse, all right? Hurts the transportation sector, but importantly, which wasn't mentioned earlier, it hurts the growth of the economy. Okay, so my views on the industry are positive and optimistic when it comes to the private sector for an obvious reason. It's incredibly competitive. We've got U.S. automakers, foreign automakers, technology companies, and most importantly, there are huge stakes. This is not the case of GM making Chevy Volt, and if it doesn't work out, you know, they'll make money with SUVs. If it doesn't work out, they're through, all right? And they cannot count on 20 years President Ivanka Trump or President Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez bailing them out. It isn't going to happen. So all of them know this. This kind of competition is exactly what we want, all right? So where are the problems in the industry? It's from public policy, all right, from the get-go. First and foremost, why didn't we have testing passed? What was the problem? Why couldn't Congress pass AV Start? Why didn't NHTSA step up? They could have done it and got a national framework for testing, all right? It really would be nice if policymakers would get behind this industry and recognize what it could do. Second, infrastructure. This is public. Automakers don't own the infrastructure. The public sector's really got to handle all of this, the city and state and ultimately national level. If they don't do anything, that's going to ground these vehicles in their place. Finally, most importantly, what inefficient highway policy has done all the way down the line, inefficient pricing, inefficient investment, inflated production costs, regulatory delays, misallocation of funding from states and cities and so on and so forth, and most importantly, constraints on technological advance and innovation. All of that, huge welfare losses to non-autonomous vehicles. It'll do exactly the same to autonomous vehicles. That is what got to improve, all right? And if you don't think this is important for the economy, suppose Trump says, you know, I've really had it with the West Coast and Washington State. Let's ground all of Boeing's planes. Let's really see what's up with them. They'll never vote for me anyway. What do you think that's going to do to the economy? It won't just be delays in the travel sector. The whole economy will be affected. Labor markets, production, trade, so on and so forth. So when you get improvements in delays, which is what autonomous vehicles can do, it affects the whole economy. We estimate about a 1 percentage point increase in GDP growth from autonomous vehicles. That's what's at stake. I will conclude with a positive note. The good thing about all of this is that everybody knows it. That is, the public sector is going to be competing. Cities, states, and government, national governments. And they already are, right? Bloomberg has a website that says, here are the cities where autonomous vehicles are being tested. They're going to have another one. Say, here's where autonomous vehicles are operating. As word gets out, and some cities and states are readying up for doing this, there will be political cost to this. So I'm hoping, in the same way that competition is really going to help this industry develop, no question in my mind about that, it will also put pressure on governments, expose the political costs, and hopefully billion-dollar bills or even trillion-dollar bills won't be lying on the sidewalk.
So many ideas, so little time. Respond to. I wanted to frame some starting comments based on a handful of questions, but I think I should also address Korok's zeroth order question, which is to observe that I have a long background, a career in science and technology policy. I've come relatively recently to autonomous vehicle safety, but that is the area in which I have been focusing when it comes to AVs. That said, I can draw from looking at the rise and the varied applications of information technologies across the board, including how policy has and hasn't worked in those areas. So my first question is, what is safety? And one of the things that surprised me in my recent work is there is no consensus definition. There's no consensus definition in general, and I found that out in talking to people at the National Safety Council as well as elsewhere, and there's no consensus definition within transportation. So at some level, we don't really know what we're talking about. In our work, we define safety as avoiding harm to people, whether they're in the vehicle or on the roadway ecosystem. You heard about crashworthiness from Derek Kahn. That's one angle. And, of course, it was interesting he didn't mention there's also occupant protection, and that's another major strand of the federal safety standards. But if we look at the last decades of the previous century, you know, we've gone from 1950s and seatbelts being very rare but beginning to appear to debating about different passive restraints in the 1970s. Then the 80s, fuel economy drove us to reduce vehicle weight, which, of course, added to safety problems. And steadily through the end of the last century, we started to see more electronics in vehicles, which is what brings us to where we are today. Where and how can AV be measured is my second question. And that is one that we looked at in depth. I'm not going to go into depth at the moment, but it is important, and again, Derek Kahn touched on this, to recognize that many things affect AV safety, beginning with the components. And so it makes a difference if your AV has cameras, radars, LIDARs, or everything, since, as we just heard, that sensor stack can be quite varied among vendors. Testing and measurement are immature. And I would say to my panel member on the left that that's one reason why we've seen some federal policy slowness, let's say, because we don't yet know enough how to do those things very well. You heard earlier that people talk about how many miles of a vehicle traveled. I have colleagues who estimated that a vehicle would have to drive hundreds of millions, if not billions of miles, for statistical confidence that there is safety. That's not happening. It's certainly not consistent with what we're seeing with the 1,400 vehicles you just heard were being tested. We are doing a lot of simulation, and simulation is very helpful. But as anybody who really understands simulation knows, you can only simulate what you know to be able to simulate. And so there are going to be situations that are rare but important and sometimes fatal that will not be captured in simulation. Finally, AV developers are not telling us what they know, and that makes it hard for policymakers to plan for safety. Part of that is because of the competition you just heard about. This is a great race, and people who are in that race don't want to share. Third question, can we compare AV safety to safety of conventional cars? Well, that's what everybody wants to do. We all know conventional cars. We want to make the comparison that's obvious. But a computer system on wheels does work differently from the combination of a human being operating something on wheels that has computers and other stuff in it. The other comment I would make on the challenge of comparing is that it may be easier to avoid being a cause of an incident as opposed to being a victim of one, and that's probably true for both AVs and conventional vehicles. If you imagine a three-lane highway, and if you are the vehicle in the middle with three vehicles to your left, three vehicles to your right, one behind you, one in front of you, if one of those vehicles screws up, there's not much that you can do about it. Fourth question. How much safety is good enough? And that relates to the question, is it reasonable to expect that AVs be at least as safe as human-driven vehicles. Safety advocates either want them to be at least as safe. Some of them actually want them to be better. I have colleagues who did an analysis that showed that once you get to that at least as safe point, then there are benefits in terms of lives saved and other problems avoided by getting those as safe vehicles out on the road. So you should beware having the perfect be the enemy of the good. And then my fifth is a grab bag of what are some other important considerations in the context for AV safety. First, AVs are not consistent in their design or operation. They operate within specified sets of circumstances. And you heard that again from Derek Kahn talking about 1,000 miles across the country and whether you do or do not encounter other vehicles or pedestrians along that way. We do expect the fleet to be mixed for a long time, and that's consistent with the slowness to getting meaningful deployment. There is a big difference in terms of safety between whether you have a minority of vehicles in the total fleet that are automated and then the majority are conventional cars driven by people, as opposed to some anticipated future where most, if not all, cars are automated. The whole world works differently in that second scenario than in the first. We do expect, again, you just heard a little bit about that, there to be more communications between vehicles, and infrastructure, between vehicles and people, and so on. But that all isn't going to happen for a long time. When it happens, it will help with safety. So finally, I would say that it's important to think about safety from a systems perspective. And I learned that when I looked at some of the work involved with what's called Vision Zero, the quest to eliminate all traffic fatalities, ideally by the middle of the century. If you're going to do that, you're going to change your vehicles, you're going to change your infrastructure, you're going to change your policy, you're going to change your incentives. Everything will change. And so as we think about what it takes to make safety, we can't focus on the AV alone. We have to think about all these factors interacting together.
Good. Thank you. So I'm not going to spend any more time on, I'll just get my clock going here, on bio, because I'm going to try to solve the world's most pressing policy problem and offer a suggestion related to autonomous vehicles and do it in about 5 minutes. So that's all I've got. So you heard Derek Kahn talk about a megatrend, and a megatrend was mass urbanization and along with it increasing traffic congestion. So as the world middle class grows, people first they want to get a car, they want to move into the cities, and they, of course, you know, drive those cars in increasingly dense environments, creating traffic congestion around the world. There's a whole slew of social problems associated with that. There's wasted fuel. There's wasted time. There's fine particulates produced from diesel fumes. We have shown that babies who grow up near increased diesel fumes have worse health outcomes. I could go on, but that is going to be and is a huge and increasing social problem. Now, to the economist looks at traffic congestion. Econ 101 says every bit of traffic congestion is due to the mispricing of the use of the road at that time. It's due to the mispricing of the use of the road at that time. That is, the price of the road is too low. If you could get the price of the road correct, you could regulate the market, both on the supply side and on the demand side, in order to make the flow of traffic through that facility smooth. So basically going at free flow. So imagine we could do that. Imagine we could, and the panel of engineers, I think, agreed that driverless cars are a way of getting people to accept road usage charges per mile a little bit better than they have in the past. They're a tool. So imagine we could do that. We could price per mile, but that price per mile is not fixed. That price per mile is variable, okay? Like the price of bread, the price of beer, the price of ties, I don't know. Those prices vary, but they vary in real time. And the price per use of the road at that particular time varies. And it varies in a way to clear the market. So when an economist says clear the market, that means that the demand for road space exactly equates to the supply,
and the cars flow through at maximum cars per hour. Now, you could imagine that market for road space clearing centrally so that there's some what we call an independent system operator, an ISO perhaps, that serves as the central clearing mechanism for that market, okay? If that seems, pie in the sky, as we sit here, the market for wholesale electricity, probably the electricity we're using in this room right now, the wholesale market, not the retail market, clears down to the second in a way to equate the supply and demand for electricity on the grid. The same is true for radio spectrum. If you went to Chicago, the market for number 10 wheat would be clearing that way. Right now, the market for pork bellies, the market for coffee, the market for orange juice, all these commodities are clearing in this, you know, sort of constant way. So imagine now that we had that data, so we knew we were pricing not only according to per mile, but in a variable way, in a way that clears the market, and then that price data were plugged into your app, okay? And that price was the key thing that, say, your Google Maps or your Waze, whatever app you want to do, was telling you how to get to work. Okay, so you say, I'm going to use an autonomous vehicle. I got to go to work. I hit the button. How much is my trip to work going to cost right now? Well, according to current road prices, it's going to cost $6.75. However, there's a little arrow. And the little arrow tells you whether the price is going down or whether the price is going up. So if the price is going down, you wait 15 minutes, answer some emails at home. You have a cheaper road price to get to work. If the road price is going up, you say, got to get in the car right now. Give me that driverless car. I'm going to work right now, okay? So that is imagine both, not just a market currently, which is what we call a spot market, but also a forward market, which is what you have in almost all commodities. But the market is a new market. It's the market for the use of road space. And that forward market, if you're worried about price risk, allows you to hedge if you're a big user, say like United Parcel Service, DHL, FedEx, you want to lock in those prices, you might hedge in the forward market for road space. So that is the basic, I think the key thing. We've talked about safety, critical issue. We've talked about potential time savings, less aggravation associated with driverless cars. But my strong hypothesis, first is that we could eliminate all, I'm using that word carefully, all traffic congestion through accurate prices of roads that would clear down to the second or every few seconds and would have a spot and a forward market. And second, leading to that, okay, to eliminate one of humanity's most pressing problems, in my view as an economist, would be the single greatest benefit of autonomous vehicles. If we could get people to think about the trip differently and the way they pay for roads differently, that would be a huge advantage. So if you want to read about this some more, I'm honored to have a paper in the journal Nature, the British journal Nature, with two esteemed economists, Peter Crampton and Axel Oakenfels. If you want to read it, give me your card that says, send me the Nature paper. And we have a longer, that's a comment almost. We have a longer paper in the academic journal called Journal of Institutional and Theoretical Economics that works all this out in gory detail about how the independent system operator would work. Peter Crampton has set up wholesale electricity markets around the world. He's also set up spectrum markets. And, we explain how this would apply to the market for road space. So as I think about this as an economist, I love safety. I think it's important. I think there's a lot of challenges, but I would hope you think about autonomous vehicles as leading to this new economic world where we accurately price the use of roads in real time. And I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you, panelists. So let me just begin with sort of a broad question. This morning we saw that there are a lot of opportunities and challenges with on the technical side of autonomous driving. And then Derek Kahn said that we're a little bit slower on the timeline than he expected. All three of you, maybe, just speculate on how do we get to a path towards adoption, both on the private side in industry as well as on the public side, in a thoughtful and proactive way. How would that happen? Go ahead.
Which is it? That
no, that's right.
Too much technology. They're not independent, right? I mean, right. The private sector, I mean, that was my point. The private sector is constrained by what the public sector is doing, mm-hmm. right? They can't just, I mean, there's sort of this Tesla fantasy. They can't just make cars and just dump them out there and say, go adopt them. I mean, this is not how non-autonomous cars worked, right? You realize that. The way we have cars out here is they still have to go through a federal regulatory inspection, right? For safety, for, you know, for safety reasons. And of course, then there's obviously licensing and all that. So, you know, this is not going to be something they can do by themselves. They're going to try to work, obviously, as quickly as they can, subject to competition. But the government really has to take the lead. First, getting the testing framework nationally. I mean, you know, this notion, Marjorie, that Mitch McConnell and Elaine Chao held up the legislation because of their concerns about AVs, it doesn't make any sense. If they were so concerned, why are they allowing the cities to do it? We have testing going on all the time now. So they haven't stopped it. I mean, they could have taken the lead. They didn't. It wasn't one of McConnell's priorities, and I really do not know what Elaine Chao cares about. But the truth is, that's what happened. And it's a fantasy to think otherwise. So that's where they have to happen. They need to take the lead to get that going. Then once that happens, then as we know, this is going to be a cooperative activity. There's going to be a lot of learning. Back on that RAND study that says we need to go X trillion miles, it's ridiculous. It was a terrible study. There's learning by doing, right? You're not just going to have to go trillion miles. Each time you drive, you're going to learn a lot. So that's obviously going to cut down the amount of time you need before these things will get well. So point being is that then we have that secondary time when they're testing and they're learning. There's obviously going to be some cooperation there. I'm not quite sure how long that will take. You know, it depends who emerges as a leader, right? And how much politics will go in. You know they're going to be low-end people. They're going to try to slow things up so that they're not going to lose. And then there's the final stage of then the transition to broader adoption, and then the policies that facilitate efficient usage. Again, all of this involves heavily involvement of the public sector.
Right.
And, you know the history. It's not great about what they do in terms of constraining efficiency, innovation, and technological change.
Marjorie, you want to add to that?
So I actually was going to go in a different direction, which I will get to. Mm-hmm. But I think what we just heard is that a reason we don't have a national framework is that we do have a situation where people are learning by doing. Not quite let a thousand flowers bloom, but we do actually benefit by having multiple experiments in multiple parts of the country by multiple government entities, multiple companies, and so on. And because they are all leading us in different ways, nationally and internationally, we are learning by doing. And although I haven't dwelled on the subject, I think that that actually provides a basis for not jumping in with a federal intervention that might be poorly informed and poorly formed. That's my response to my colleague to my left. But I think in terms of how might we move forward, it is interesting. You know, there were some references by Derek Kahn to liability. And liability is driving many people to assume that when these vehicles come on the road, they're likely to be deployed as parts of fleets. You know, we can talk about Tesla all we want, which is making an individual consumer retail play. But we're talking about vehicles where if that sensor stack is not well maintained, then there is a risk that the vehicle will not perform as it is supposed to do. And if there is no human driver, then the only people who are going to be blamed are the owners, operators, developers of the fleets. They have a lot of incentive to get it right, and I think that is how we're going to see some of the initial rollout.
So great. So to review, the question is how do we get adoption?
Yeah.
And we go back to Cliff's point that all the infrastructure assets that are discussed here are publicly owned. The states are owned entirely, the interstate highway system is entirely owned by states. I don't think there's a foot of it anymore that's owned by the federal government. There's city streets, there's county roads. All these assets are owned by some public owner.
If there's not owned by anybody, let's go get some free infrastructure. But of course, of course they are. So you have to deal with public owners. So one thing that concerns me about these discussions is, it was alluded to on the last engineering panel a little bit, is about the public ownership of the infrastructure assets. So to get any of this stuff deployed in a serious way, you have to take their interests and their incentives, their budget constraints, et cetera, into account. So, running the Infrastructure Policy Center for the past 10 years at Cornell, I love these people. They're all wonderful. They are risk averse. If you're the state highway official, the worst thing for you is to see something about the highway system on the front page of the newspaper tomorrow. You bear all the downside, but you don't bear the upside. They're budget constrained. So if you go with them to a proposal to spend money, it's probably going to go in one ear and out the other. So what I'm going to launch a term that I would like everybody to keep in mind. It's called value capture. Okay, I don't know how many people have heard of value capture, but you've heard of it. It's a great, I know Baruch's heard of it. It's a great term that is gaining traction in infrastructure policy. So the idea is that there's enormous value in everything we're talking about. The value is latent in autonomous vehicles. There's safety value, maybe congestion reduction, et cetera. The question is, how do you share that value with public sector officials in a way that they benefit from the adoption? If I have time for a quick example from my own town of Ithaca, New York, in upstate, we had a 100-year, I love sewage treatment plants, that's what I do. We have a 100-year-old sewage treatment plant, the same thing with the big settling pools and skimmers, et cetera. Tremendous methane dispersion into the atmosphere. Methane's a bad greenhouse gas. Johnson Controls comes in and says, hey, folks, we will install a methane digester, which is a giant white sphere larger than this room, that will capture the methane as it's processed. We will use that methane to turn three or four called microturbines that turn at 120,000 RPMs. Those microturbines will produce electricity for this plant, enough to cover the whole cost of the electricity for operating this plant. And we will install that technology to you, the city of Ithaca, at absolutely no cost. The way we pay for it is allow us to capture some of your reduced electricity bill. We'll bond against that and raise the money to install the technology. I got a tour of the plant. It's so successful, the city of Ithaca sewage treatment plant is selling electricity outside the plant onto the grid. Johnson Controls or somebody's going to install another methane digester. Neighboring counties are actually bringing waste to be processed, paying the city of Ithaca to do that processing. And I believe the water discharged into Cayuga Lake is actually cleaner than it was before. So I urge us to think about applying that model to driverless cars. One super valuable thing are the streetlight poles, right? The poles themselves, you can put up cameras, 5G, et cetera. You can install LED lights instead of pressurized sodium that will give you more lumens at a lower electricity cost. Just share some of that with the public sector owner so that they gain and say, by the way, we want to, help us with the autonomous vehicle thing. So think about those win-win situations that don't require the public sector to spend money and are low risk. And I think it's part of the solution.
Thank you, Rick. So I actually want to follow up on that point. We've heard a lot about infrastructure today, and you're an expert on infrastructure financing. And tell us a little bit more about how smart infrastructure in particular could develop in the future under new and novel financing arrangements that were possibly not possible under the kind of the older model. What new opportunities does this all of this new technology bring on the infrastructure side?
Great question. I mean, I think that a lot of old structures should be relied upon first, and that's one of the things I've learned as a sort of observer and commentator on this area is that everything in this sector is risky. Anytime, just think about building a bridge. Okay, kind of a common thing, but everything about that is risky. There's design risk in the bridge. There's construction risk. There's geotechnical risk. There's strike risk. There's operating risk. There's acts of God, force majeure risk. I could go on down the line. And so the companies involved in this, risk is like a hot potato. They want to get rid of it, right? And so they're trying to distance themselves or control the risk as much as they can. So a disaster with the infrastructure doesn't bring down the parent company. So what they do, this is lawyer intensive, is they form SPVs, special purpose vehicles, which are these legally created entities that manage the risk. They issue debt and equity themselves. They are the actual legally contracting entity. So to deploy these, this new, trust me, this is all risky. What we've everything we talked about today is risky. To deploy this, and that's the key thing is that the debt issued by the special purpose vehicle is issued by revenues coming into the SPV only. So that's called project financing. Mm-hmm. So we would use project financing structures particularly. One of the interesting things, I'll just a footnote, is bond life. In other words, the bond market usually has 5, 10, 15, 20, you know, very fixed term bonds. And I think that matching the bond life to the payback is getting more flexibility in that bond market, whether it's tax-exempt municipal bonds or taxable corporate bonds, is something we could do to help facilitate this. But what I would do is go back, look at, you know, there's a whole world of finance, of this infrastructure finance on Wall Street and elsewhere. Take that expertise and think about how to modify existing project financing models to adapt to the new technology.
Yeah, Cliff, go ahead.
So an interesting thing historically in this country and probably everywhere else is modes, virtually all of them, lead infrastructure. We first had cars before we had roads. We first had planes before we had airports and air traffic control and so on. And that is how I think it's important to think about how autonomous vehicle infrastructure will evolve. We're going to first have the vehicles. They're going to continue to get better before we get the technology and infrastructure to accommodate them. Now, what's going to be interesting, though, is effectively the pressure that autonomous vehicles are going to put on infrastructure providers. Normally, people tend to think about financing, which is, you know, not unreasonable. However, there's going to be something else they're going to have to think about, and that is the performance of their infrastructure, because if it performs badly, it'll significantly compromise autonomous vehicles' performance. If it performs well, it'll enhance autonomous vehicles' technology performance. Now, there'll be a number of ways, both economic and technological, that this infrastructure can succeed. As I noted, just messing up on pricing and investment in things that should have been done with non-autonomous vehicles but were never done cost us quite a bit. But that's masked over the fact that we spend so much money to cover it up and have trillions of dollars invested. That really will show up with autonomous vehicles. We will have induced demand. So if they're concerned about congestion and you don't introduce congestion pricing, that's obviously going to compromise to a significant extent what autonomous vehicles can do. If you do not build the roads properly and you have a lot of potholes, autonomous vehicles aren't going to like that. And that's going to really hurt their performances. They try to figure out what to do. If you're going to blow the chance to optimize on capacity and now making lanes thinner or narrower, which you now can do, instead of making them wider, anticipating there'd be free flow traffic that never materialized, that's going to waste a lot of capacity. That's just on the economic side. On the technological side, that's going to be harder, because you're then going to have to start interacting with the vehicle and say, okay, at various levels, at the street level, optimizing stoplights, things like that. The question I asked earlier in the day was basically getting at the point, we have not changed traffic light technology for decades. They're based on the assumed traffic flows that exist. So when you show up at 2 a.m. and see a red light and there's no one around and you're wondering, why isn't this thing turning green or blinking red, you can thank the decades-old policy that is still used to do that. Obviously, that's the kind of thing we want to be changing with autonomous vehicles. Then more broadly, trying to coordinate then massive movement of autonomous vehicles on highways and so on and so forth, that now is open for a lot of different explorations. Utah is partnering with a private sector entity. Colorado is partnering with a private sector entity, all trying to look at best ways to do this kind of thing. But I think ultimately of the autonomous vehicles getting out there, they're going to put the push on the infrastructure to develop, and then the competition will exist, and we will see what best practices are, and we'll see the costs and benefits of who succeeds.
I would just add that picking up on the point I ended on about safety being a system, a lot of what's going to happen with AVs is going to fit into a larger system of activities. So land use planning is going to change. You know, some of that pressure on road use that Rick had talked about may change with AVs because they can go in sort of bizarre routes and park themselves and do things that we don't expect to see with people. And cities are going to plan for that. Cities are, in fact, as you've just heard, working on their traffic management systems. And between them and the interactions with AVs, we now have new cybersecurity concerns. That's another risk that is going to drive investment, because if you don't attend to that, you're going to have huge problems. So I think systemically we'll see a number of motivators for investment and for creative responses.
So let's talk more about safety, given that Derek and Ken both said it's the kind of the number one priority. And you've mentioned this before. So we're now in a world where, say, 40,000 fatalities a year on U.S. highways, and there's one crash in Arizona, and Uber shuts down their program. If there is such an emphasis on safety, how are we going to get there if all technology is very preliminary and there's going to be some growing pains? How do we overcome that when even if there's a long-term benefit? But there's going to be short-term costs, and how do we, as a society, get there?
Well, you heard from Derek Kahn that the projections have changed for when we're going to see significant deployment, real commercial deployment. And I think that that is a reflection of industry recognizing that the problem is harder than they thought it was. And so having this internalized adaptation is going to be critical. I think because of the competition that I mentioned before among developers, we have yet to see a true sense of shared fate. That is, it wasn't, Uber had the problem, therefore I, Waymo, am clean. Everybody suffers. Public trust and confidence suffers when there's any incident. So one of the things that my report had recommended is that when there is an incident, because it is so uncommon, that people share information. And again, you heard Derek Kahn talking about an aviation example. But the more people in the business share information, at least among themselves, arguably also with the government, the more we will learn from these scarce incidents and be able to progress together. But the most important phenomenon that we see now is that people have lowered the temperature of their enthusiasm and the hype, and I think people are self-moderating.
Can I address that?
Yeah, go for it.
So it's great. Great question, Kirk. So to me, it's analogous to what I tell my policy students at Cornell about type 1 versus type 2 error at the FDA, where type 1 error is you release a drug that actually harms people. Type 2 error is where you don't release a drug that actually helps people. Right. And you see the type 1 error, but the type 2 error is like an opportunity cost that you don't see. So I think part of the role of policy people is to emphasize the cost of not having a safer autonomous vehicle. So, you know, the weird things I calculate, many people up here have probably been to the Vietnam War Memorial and look at all the names on that wall, the terrible loss. It takes us about 18.23 months to kill that number of people on U.S. roads and highways, okay? So that visualizes it. They're disproportionately young people, just horrible carnage on the roads today. So every week, every day, we don't have this new technology deployed. All these young people, those crosses you see on the highways, were being lost because of majority's human error. So I think the job of economists is to hammer on opportunity cost, use the type 1 versus type 2 error, you know, analogy, and just say, look, yes, we know someone was killed in Arizona. It's terrible. It's horrible. But we have to. This is better than the massive, you know, people drinking and people texting and everything else that's causing this carnage on the roads. And just keep stressing that.
So when Derek was mentioning his example, I don't know if any of you market-oriented people were thinking the same way I was, but he's talking about airlines landing and one of them having a problem and saying, you know, why can I share that with all my fellow pilots? Where was the FAA? Why didn't the FAA take note of that? What if the FAA says, hey, we'll keep track of all of this when you have a problem, and we are in charge of promoting safety in this industry, and we will make it aware to all of you, you know, when a pilot has a problem at one of our airports. And then hopefully that will help induce cooperation. Where were they? Why did we have to have the private sector say, hey, why don't we organize and have a cooperative effort where we solve this problem? Well, I'll give you my answer in a second. But this is how things work when you're dealing with the government. I mean, these are things now that are occurring even now. Already there have been coalitions of various automakers and technology companies now in autonomous vehicles to promote safety, okay? Whereas, again, and I don't know why this hasn't gotten across, the federal government has to actually authorize the standards for autonomous vehicles for them to be sold. They can't unless that happens. Congress authorizes NHTSA to do it. That's what we need the legislation for. Then they can sell cars. They can't do it before that. All right. They have to take the lead. That's just the law. Okay. And that's really what we should be looking for. But we're not getting that kind of leadership. All right. Ultimately, it's going to come pushing from the private sector to do it. And they're frustrated because they really would like the public sector to engage, but they don't. Why? Status quo bias. If you look repeatedly, decade after decade, policies that should have changed long ago, they don't. And then when you have technology being such a challenge as it is, these guys don't know what to do. And that's what, and this is not new. This has been going on forever. And it's probably going to continue to go on forever. It's going to be an uphill fight. But hopefully, through these demonstrations, and again, this is a global effort, so it will get attention in this country too, we'll get somewhere. But it's going to be a lot harder than it has to be. Defend the government.
I think, if I recall correctly, Brookings has published a lot of work talking about regulatory capture. And the fact is, in a lot of industries where there is regulation, the government can never understand the world as well as the people that it is trying to regulate. Sure. I cannot forecast well enough what will happen in this space, but I have seen and read enough about what happens when regulatory policy goes wrong to understand that if the whole system, the industry, the governments at different levels, if everybody goes a little slower, maybe we have more of a chance of getting it right.
So I have one more question for the panel, then we'll open it up. And the question is about sort of long-term costs and benefits from autonomous transportation, in particular for, say, the labor market and the capital market. And so what are some things maybe we haven't discussed yet of benefits or costs of autonomous technology, say, for all of the truck drivers in the U.S. today, or for the price of land across the country? Can you either speculate on that or offer any opinions?
Okay, so I actually answered that, but let me fill that in. You know, I told you there's an estimate of GDP growth. Okay, the intuition, I gave you one intuition with Boeing. Let me go back further. Let's go back to the Stone Age, when we did not have a transportation system. Okay, so all your production was, you know, where you lived in your cave. You know, you worked where you lived in your cave. You know, so on and so forth. Okay, what did transportation do? What it did is enable you to get all the benefits of modern economy, economies of scale. You can produce and sell to many places. Product diversity. You didn't have to eat the same, I don't know what you ate then, bison or something. You know, competition, diversity in labor. You know, all these markets opened up. So you can think of infinite congestion in the limit, that's the Stone Age. You can't move. All right. So as you get incremental improvements in congestion, basically what you're doing is opening up all the things in an economy that we get from a transportation system. And that's what autonomous vehicles will do. not just the transportation system, but they're going to open up all these sectors. Now, admittedly, we're not where we were in the Stone Age, but we obviously suffer from pretty extreme congestion that affects everything, labor, trade, competition, so on and so forth. So the hope with autonomous vehicles operating efficiently with the right technology and the right economic policy is we will get these congestion improvements that'll make the whole economy come alive even more. Now, it's disruptive. Again, governments don't like it. Labor markets, some do. Some parts do, some parts don't. Obviously, labor gets hurt when there's capital labor substitution. Okay, so the truck drivers, obviously, in the seat, they're out of work. All right, and that's the offsetting part or the negative part that people get nervous about. It's disruptive. Okay, but the two other parts that offset that are very important. One, productivity increases, output goes up more. So even taking the technology as constant, okay, you're at least going to do more. And you need at least some labor. You're not completely substituting away from all labor to produce that output. But here's the big ticket item. New occupations. All kinds of things will open up with new technologies. Jobs that we didn't have before. New things we didn't have before. And what's important is with the growth of the tech companies and the tech economy, most of the new jobs or a large fraction of the new jobs are in new classifications of occupation. So you put that all together and you're saying, yes, there will be some loss in employment from capital labor substitution, but productivity increases and the creation of new jobs are quite likely to offset that. And obviously there are going to have to be adjustments, as there always are with a new technology.
So I want to address that. So I agree with everything Cliff said. Cliff has done more analysis on this, but just kind of a broader view. If you think about transportation in general, you know, it's been treated almost like utility in the thinking about it. So nobody should go without clean water. Nobody should go without electricity. Once we have that, nobody should go without a number of other maybe communications. Nowadays, nobody should go without heat. And, that's just, I think, a great part of American society is we sort of believe these basic needs should be met. And that's been true for transportation for a long time. So in the early part of the 1900s, there was something called the Farms to Markets movement. And this was the idea that farmers had all these crops that they were growing more than they could ever eat themselves, and they wanted to get it to market. But a lot of the roads were dirt roads, so when it rained, they couldn't move their crops to market. So there was this rural road movement to try to get the farmers to allow them, to get their crops to market. And then the very name of the interstate highway system is to connect the nation together, sort of the old postal service notion of binding the nation together, except it was done through a system of interstate highways. So as we move to this new technology, I guess I'll just tell another quick story. Everybody here who's in D.C. in January should go to the Transportation Research Board meetings, the TRB. And I love that meeting, right? And they have an exhibit hall there. They have all cool – they had an autonomous car last January. It's early January. They had a car moving back and forth. I think you could ride in it. But one time I went there, and it was a couple years ago, and there were these guys, kind of interesting-looking guys, standing next to a vehicle that was on one of the earlier slides, which was an autonomous bus, maybe 6 or 8 seater, right? And, I said, this is interesting. What do you know? They said that we're running this around Boston, right? And we're running. I said, really, that's really cool. And I said, but doesn't that – there's an MTA in Boston. Don't they have exclusive rights to – operate buses in Boston? I'm a policy guy, right? So how do you overcome this? And they said, we're running our autonomous bus where the MTA in Boston doesn't serve. I'm not indicting them, just doesn't serve these underserved areas. And he explained to me the way the app worked. You have an app and they say, this autonomous bus, you are 2 blocks from this autonomous bus stop. 5 other people want to ride this bus from A to B. Come to this corner in 6 minutes. And this autonomous bus will take you from A to B, okay, at a very low cost, okay? And so that's how they were doing it. So there are these gaps. We don't think any neighborhood should be cut off from some form of transportation. There are these gaps in our system that I think autonomous transportation is filling, right? So I see that. Now, how does that get back to your jobs question? A key thing is access to jobs. Is that can people get to jobs? In New York City, where I spent a lot of time, it's really expensive to own a car, right? So you have to have some form of public transportation to get to a job. And I think that if we, you know, creatively use autonomous vehicles, they can help solve that age-old transportation problem of really providing universal service. And that's just one example.
I would just add that when it comes to trucks, we benefit again from the fact that technology is not changing as fast as people think. So if you talk to people who are in the trucking industry, they talk about various assists, and they talk about first assistance in the long haul portions as opposed to the, you know, getting on and off of a highway and so on. There are also people who will talk about how the age structure of the commercial driving population is relatively high because those jobs are not attractive to younger people. So there can be problems getting enough people to do today's trucking jobs. If you add that together with slower than some people would like to see deployment, you may have a self-correcting problem, which is not to say that some people will not lose work. And certainly opportunities will be foreclosed. But as the new kinds of opportunities that Cliff mentioned come online, again, the system may regulate itself, and I end up being a little bit less worried about trucking than I do about other kinds of jobs.
Okay, let's open it up to questions. I know people might be nervous about asking the first question, so let's go straight to the second question. You want to go?
Thank you. Actually, I would like to ask three questions in 1 minute, if it's possible. Marjorie Brubenthal about AV timing. Aren't we asking too much of AVs without providing a lot of support from all of us? Because the assumption is AVs are super intelligent machines looking for zombies on the unorganized asphalt when we have urban planning that could organize the urban mobility by speed and by modality. And we have psychologists and educators that could educate the population in terms of behavior. A second question for Rick, if I may. Land value capture and public goods and public value. My overarching principle is if you have an agency that provides a public good, it should have an endowment. Endowment. Such as land-grant universities in this country, long tradition, such as foundations, such as metro that has land. Public transit is one of those. So you can use land value capture like Tokyo and Hong Kong in order to provide that additional support. Third question to Clifford Winston. Mayor Bowser wants to spend a ton of money to buy 9 electrical buses. They would be expensive. No, I have a lot of respect for the mayor. This is my person. But that would be expensive to buy. It would be expensive to operate and logistically difficult. Wouldn't it be better to use a pilot on those red corridors and have something like Navia, you know, pilot the shuttles, electrical and AV. Thank you very much.
Yeah, just to give everyone a chance, maybe just answer one of those questions. We just want to pick. Yeah. Yeah.
I think in response to your question, when I was talking about a systems approach or referring in response to something that Rick had said to land use planning, I agree that there are many kinds of planning, many kinds of personnel that have to complement the vehicles themselves. It's never just the vehicle themselves. And, you know, we heard earlier about public awareness. Even some of that work, perhaps it's the psychologist you were referring to, to advise the public on what it is they can expect. You know, there was a case in Boston where a consulting group got together with the city government, I think it was, and had an AV petting zoo. I mean, that's just a way to, you know, get people exposed, because you have to pay money to get into TRB, and you know, we need to help the rest of us.
Maximize.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, let's just keep it quick, so we got to...
All right. Yeah. I'll alienate the rest of you. Look, public transit was an experiment in this country. Okay, initially we had private transit. It was before public. All right, it's been a mistake economically, as it's turned out. It was an experiment that failed. From an economic perspective, if you look at the user benefits and even account for any savings and externalities and congestion reductions and compare that with the costs and now the huge and ever-growing subsidies they get, they are not socially desirable, all right? And the advent of network transportation companies like Uber and Lyft is just putting the final nail in the coffin. Transit was just a mistake. It'll be one of the benefits of autonomous vehicles is it'll make it increasingly clear that those systems should be eliminated and that we will have effectively personal transit companies. So I am not supportive of any spending on transit. If anything, I think we need to realize that subsidizing people like myself, you know, from coming in from the suburbs really just has not worked out, and that the mobility that autonomous vehicles will get us will give us the final push to get rid of those systems.
Okay, let's take the next question. Let's see. How about right there? Yeah, you. Can you stand up so we can identify? Yeah.
Hi, I'm Etta Nahapetian from Fairfax County, Virginia, and we are working on trying to get an autonomous shuttle happening over the next few months in Fairfax, and we're focusing on making a transit solution because we think the opposite, that we're hoping that these AVs become help us get to a transit solution so we don't have this crazy increase in traffic. As you might know, Fairfax has a lot of traffic. So we're really struggling with some of the regulatory issues and figuring out how we're going to work through the NHTSA waiver process. We're partnering with Dominion. They're going to help purchase our vehicle, but as we're trying to jockey to figure out what kind of vehicle we're going to get, we're struggling with the NHTSA waiver process. And I guess maybe this was a question for Derek Kahn, but do you know if there's any kind of movement to not make it such a black box? You know, it is a black box to local government to whether what the regulatory requirements will be.
The simple answer is I don't know, but that sounds like a question for the Conference of Mayors or League of Cities, who I know are looking at some of these issues.
Okay, great. Now, next question up here in the front. Yeah. Great.
Thank you. I had a question about the safety elements of autonomous vehicles. If you look at sort of everything USDOT is saying and what a lot of the OEMs are saying, safety first, safety is our top priority. Presumably from the OEMs, that's because they see a consumer desire to hear that the vehicles are safe. But then what Rick was saying earlier is we already accept a vast amount of fatality on the road as consumers. And so there's something about our personal utility choice that we decide to make these trips when we know the statistics and we know how dangerous it is. So how do you reconcile that moving forward? What's the barrier there from an, I guess, economics perspective, which I don't know anything about, and how do we push past that?
I mean, I guess it's to go back to the FDA. I'm old enough to remember the AIDS crisis, and there was the AIDS cocktail, and it wasn't 100% solution, but the FDA was holding up the deployment of those drugs, and the gay community got together, and they lobbied, and they demonstrated, and they said, look, you know, some of us have AIDS, and this drug is available, you know, let us have it, right? So I would take, I mean, it's a heroic analogy, but I would take that, and again, I think economists are not vocal enough in pointing out opportunity costs. This is something we cover in the first week of Econ 101, right? Is the things you do see, you know, which are the people who die from the AV in Arizona, and the things you don't see. The things you don't see are the people who would be alive today if they had had an AV instead of the human error that's killing, you know, 30,000 people every year. And so I think the role of policy people and economists in particular is to be much more vocal about the opportunity costs and to say, yes, fatalities are terrible, but, you know, in the deployment of any, I mean, aviation was like that early on. It wasn't long after the Wright brothers flew that the first person was killed in an airplane crash. So you know, I'm not minimizing that harm, but I'm saying we have to stress the harm to society of not having the technology deployed, and these regulatory holdups are killing people. I could give you other analogies, but you get the point.
What you're getting at, though, it's important, is the notion of what we call heterogeneity. See, there isn't this we. We're all different. In other words, when you look at the breakdown of auto fatalities, what do you see? You know, drunk driving, right? Not wearing a seatbelt, texting. It's what we call heterogeneity. All right, I'm going to trash the engineers for a second. Okay. There was a question about what major one should have to do this stuff. Learning a little econometrics wouldn't hurt. This is what the engineering safety works. It's just awful. They go out and they get police accident reports, all right, and they fit models of what we call severity, all right, and they use the data on the police accidents reports, okay? Were they drinking? Were they speeding? Was there a hairpin curve? You know, all that kind of stuff, right? And they, you know, draw results from that. Well, the obviously dumb thing about that is there's self-selection. Right, you only are in that sample if you got it in accident, right? It's not a random sample. What you'd want is a sample that has everybody, and most of those people don't get in accidents. They take actions, right, to prevent that. That's what autonomous vehicles are doing. They're eliminating the heterogeneity. All the dumb decisions that people have made to self-select and put themselves out in a snowstorm, you know, when they run into somebody, you know, or after they've been drinking, or run into somebody, or run off the road, autonomous vehicles are going to say, sorry, you can be that way, but once you get in us, you're all the same, all right? And that's really how we're going to get the improvements, is we're cutting the heterogeneity, making everyone the same.
Okay, let's say, yeah, go ahead.
Carl Golovin, I'm wondering if a defining moment will come when apparently Tesla is working to set up its own insurance company for Tesla owners, as well as its own collision repair, because you know, their cars are unique enough, you don't want to take them to a traditional repair shop. So once the owners of Teslas and Tesla itself, through its insurance company, is willing to accept the liability, that the assurance that they believe their self-driving vehicles are sufficiently safe, they're willing to incur the liability, won't that be a moment when many Teslas already on the road will become autonomous?
They can't sell them. They're going to need federal approval before they can sell them. They can put anything they want in them. They cannot sell them and operate them.
I also don't think that a model of complete vertical integration where a company does everything and self-insures is scalable. So it would be interesting to see what happens, but we've heard a lot of announcements and pronouncements coming out of that company, and then reality, you know, looks a little bit different.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I'm not going to worry about that one.
Okay, let's take one in the front. Yeah.
It seems like I call this NEAT system, Network Electric Automated Transport. It seems like this whole NEAT system is based on having $700 mobile smartphone with a $40 to $80 a month data plan in order to be able to use it. Is there a way, you see the future being able to use and hail a system transport like this without such a device in your pocket, or is it just assuming that you have to pay this expensive data plan and have this $400 iPhone thing in your pocket in order to use this network transport. That's my question. Thanks.
Right now, there are a number of models that people are experimenting with for different kinds of platforms supporting mobility as a service. Some of them draw on public information as well as private information. This is an evolving space, and AVs are a part of it. My guess is that just as all of that kind of matching and planning and payment services, as that's evolving, we'll also end up with different approaches to accessing it. So if there is a digital divide issue, which is what I think you're getting at, then we'll also be looking at some alternative public kiosks or other options. They may not be as flexible as having a device in your pocket, but ideally, for reasons that have been covered by others, government, local government will make that kind of thing happen. And we may end up with different kinds of technology innovation that will lower the costs of the communications and information aspects.
Let's take last question. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Dorothy Robine. Oh, I'm sorry. A comment to Cliff and a question for Rick. And I usually agree with Cliff, but I think that I think the FAA was very involved in the AIS program. I know they were very involved in developing a sister program, which encouraged pilots to share information on near-miss accidents. There were so few accidents beginning around that time that you needed to start to extract information from near misses. And so the FAA encouraged pilots to do that and gave them the same sort of indemnification that the ASIAS program. So I would give FAA credit for that one. My question for Rick, Derek Kahn said the federal government was neutral between internal combustion engines and EVs. This was in response to a question. Internal combustion engines create carbon emissions. That's another unpriced externality. Do you agree that the federal government should be neutral in the AV debate between electric vehicles and or hydrogen fuel cell and internal combustion?
You mean, so you're asking my own personal
yes.
view on?
So, well, your policy view as an economist.
Yeah. So I'm sort of in favor of electrification. I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons to reduce fossil fuel usage. Carbon dioxide is one of those. There's others. One thing, and I think there's this sense that autonomous vehicles and electric vehicles are kind of converging. So just, yep. Again, to underscore my earlier point, I hope that a takeaway from my earlier comments is that everybody thinking about this will think about real-time road pricing as the third piece. Right, so autonomous vehicles, electric, and road pricing is kind of converging, right? So I am not fuel agnostic, and would take a little bit longer to talk through that. I can think of a number of reasons. One thing though that I'll just say that is a cautionary note, and one of the great things about me as an economist studying infrastructure is I get to talk to engineers a lot more, different part of campus, and they're very concerned about infrastructure resilience, particularly in the state of New York after Hurricane Sandy. That was a big thing for our state. And one of the things you do, and I'll just toss it out there, when you rely more on electric vehicles, you integrate the transportation system with the electric system more profoundly. So if somebody were to take down the grid and you can't get a charge on your vehicle, that's a real problem. Right. And we study hurricanes. One of the biggest problems is actually the impact of the hurricane on infrastructure itself is big, but people can't get fuel after the hurricane. The pumps themselves at gas stations run on electricity. Right. So that one of the biggest impacts is the days after the hurricanes where people can't get fuel. So I'm just cautioning to think about the impact of integrating your transportation system more deeply with your power grid, because your power grid then should be much more stronger, resilient to either natural disasters, terrorist attacks, cyber events, et cetera. So I'll just toss it out there. But I personally am not fuel agnostic. I think there's reasons to favor electrification.
Okay, we are out of time. So let's respect everyone's time. Thank you to the panelists. If you have further questions, you can come up.
All right, we are going to get started now. Thank you all, first of all, for being here for this really exciting conversation about how autonomous vehicles are going to change the world and the ways that we need to change the world to accommodate them and what role we want them to play in our world. We're going to be talking about public policy. Policymakers have struggled to develop a framework for bringing autonomous vehicles onto our roads. The House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a bill in 2017, which got bogged down in the Senate last year and died there. The Department of Transportation, as you heard from Derek Kahn, has published 3 versions of voluntary guidance, but no binding regulations. So that's kind of the environment that we find ourselves in right now. I'm Tanya Snyder. I'm a transportation reporter for Politico Pro. Hopefully you all subscribe to Politico Pro Transportation, or at least read Morning Transportation. And if you don't, come talk to me afterwards. And I want to introduce the panel, too. To my left is Tom Adrecki, Vice President of Supply Chain and Logistics for the Grocery Manufacturers Association. Beth Kegel, Vice President at HNTB and Director of their Smart and Connected Solutions Program. Baruch Feigenbaum, Assistant Director of Transportation Policy at the Reason Foundation. And Jyot Chadha from the New Urban Mobility Alliance at the World Resources Institute's Ross Center for Sustainable Cities. She leads NUMO's work to develop partnerships on tech and mobility. So thank you all for being here. Thank you all for being here. I want to start with this question of not just the ways that we need to transform our cities and places for autonomous vehicles, but the way that we can put them to work to make our cities and places the best cities that they can be. We hear a lot about potential benefits and that seem to solve a lot of the most vexing issues that cities have about congestion, emissions, safety, access, mobility. How can cities best put these to work so that, you know, we're not just sort of making space to accommodate what industry wants to throw at us, but that we are using them for our own purposes?
Can you hear me now? Okay, great. That's why it helps to be flexible. Well, when it comes to one of the things that I'll share with you about my background is prior to coming to HNTB, I was a Florida Transportation Commissioner for 7.5 years, and I led a Chamber of Commerce at the same time for about 7 years. So I come at this from a little bit of a different perspective, kind of a combination of policy, technology, and then understanding community engagement and economic development and quality of life issues. So first and foremost, I would say we heard a lot about, we all here today, we've been educated quite a bit, I think, on the things that we've heard. Think about some of the localities out there and how much they do not know and understand. So in terms of what cities can do, cities first and foremost can start to really become educated on the benefits and the risks of what is happening with autonomous and connected technology. The other thing I would say is to be open to actually bring pilots into your city. I think that's critically important because not only is it something that might help the AV entities, but it also helps you learn more about your city. Where the pitfalls are and things of that nature, where do you need to improve? Miami and Ford had a really great relationship when Ford came in with their AV testing down in Miami, as you might expect, a very congested environment, just an interesting place to test. So great information for all to get. I would also say that collaboration is very, very important as a city and even as a county between private and public sector entities of all kinds. I led a chamber in Palm Beach County. We actually were able to immerse all of our entities in an education about autonomous connected vehicles as well as smart city technologies. When you start bringing together not only elected officials and administrators from cities, not only private sector participants, including hospitals and others, you start bringing all of them together along with the Urban League and what have you, really start to get an education about how these advancements can really advance a locality and be better for quality of life. And I heard earlier, competitiveness, because we are in a global market, and how our quality of life stacks up and what kind of efficiencies we have within our regions and our localities, the more competitive we're going to be as well.
Great. Whoever wants to take it next.
I think just building on what you said, I think that one of the really important things to also consider as a city, and as you like proactively consider the deployment, like the future deployment of AV technology, is that this isn't occurring or isn't going to occur in a vacuum. And so there are many different things happening sort of all at the same time, right? So if you have just the tremendous sort of growth and demand for e-commerce delivery, for example, prior to my role at GMA, was the director of urban innovation and mobility at UPS. And so I would talk to cities all the time about just the tremendous influx of demand that curb spaces is, you know, in the sort of the strain of that physical real estate asset in a city, and how that demand shift is happening. You have the emergence of micromobility. You have the emergence of TNC. Like, all of these things are happening, and so you can't, I think, just say like, well, let's take the AV bucket, or let's just take the TNC development. All of this is happening at once, and so as a city, I think you need to adopt this very sort of like integrated, proactive view.
So I would say, I think one of the questions is, what about cars? Because obviously cities have got concerns about congestion and about mobility, and as was mentioned, about the curb space, because it's going to be a lot of competition. And so our approach at Reason, not surprisingly, as a free market approach, has been pricing. And I know it was mentioned a little bit on the past panel, but I think there's a lot you can do with pricing. If you're worried about zero occupant vehicles, sort of the zombie cars, as they're sometimes called, roaming around, then you can price those vehicles higher. If you want to encourage carpooling, you can price those vehicles lower or not at all. Now, we don't have a great history for carpooling in this country. There's a lot of hope, and Alan Kornhauser at Princeton has spoken on this, for those of you familiar with him, that with some of the automated vehicles and the improvements with ride sharing and what we see even today with smartphones, there's going to be a lot more of that. We also have to talk about the 800-pound gorilla, which is transit. And obviously, in some metro areas, New York, D.C., others, transit as we have it now works okay. I'm not going to go quite as far as Cliff went and said it's a total disaster, but it needs a lot of improvement in a lot of places, and it's not great. And I think automated vehicles can do a lot of that in terms of maybe getting rid of the labor costs down the road, looking at smaller vehicles, right-sizing. I think partnerships with the private sector is going to be important as well, working with Uber and Lyft for some of the low-density routes. We say that already with first mile and last mile. So I think pricing for cars and figuring out how we can make transit better are two important things.
Is that on? Okay. So I think I'll focus a little bit on what Tom brought up, which is on micromobility. And I'll just take a quick poll. How many of us have been on a shared scooter or a shared cycle? Okay, that's a lot. The point of view that I think I'm coming from is that today we have that opportunity to start flexing our muscle and start to have discussions and pilot and experiment on the topics that will be important when AVs are eventually on our roads, today itself with micromobility. So some of the topics that are hot with micromobility right now is the use of space and the allocation of space, is pricing, as you're saying, and thinking about what are the different models behind that around regulation, around permits, thinking about market entry. And I think we really do have that opportunity today to start laying some of that groundwork for when AVs are actually on our streets. Where micromobility and AVs differ, though, I think, is that in the current ecosystem that we have today, AVs could very well fit into the space that we have for personal cars. And I think that we do have the opportunity today, cities and other stakeholders do need to come together and think about, like, how do we use this moment in time to really think about the goals for our cities and what sort of cities we're trying to live in. So we would really push for cities that are active and are shared in terms of mobility. So thinking about a 20-minute neighborhood, we think that clearly land use and planning plays a really big part of making that happen. But a lot of these new mobility entrants are starting to add to the possibilities in that space. So I really think that engaging on the topics that are at hand today gives us that platform to be able to get our cities into a position that we have the right sort of infrastructure, we have the right public-private partnerships, we have the right mode choices that we would want for different types of trips and different types of purposes and different types of populations.
Picking up there a little bit, how, as we think about remaking our infrastructure for a new autonomous era, how do we avoid some of the mistakes of the highway era, where highways were built through low-income neighborhoods, where they accelerated sprawl? How do we make sure that we are working sustainability and social equity into that infrastructure?
Well, going back to the point that I said, you have to start looking at that data and the statistics and putting them at the forefront to really bring that to reality. One of the things that I would talk about, since I am from Florida and I served on the commission, Florida actually is embarking on its Florida Transportation Plan, and they're putting some of those statistics right front and center with all of the stakeholders that are looking at it. So looking at how many people live within a half a mile of a healthy food source, looking at how many live below the poverty line, how many households do not have a bank account. Actually, 8.4 million households in our country do not have a bank account. Transportation in Florida is the third highest household cost for a family. 56.5% of our residents live within a half a mile of fixed route transit. So that means the rest of them don't. So we're actually putting those issues at the forefront and having those discussions so that that is part of our overall transportation and smart city planning. So social equity is becoming more and more a hot topic. I mean, it's a national discussion relative to this and others. So the more leadership that's taken within our communities and our states and et cetera on this, the more we'll include those in our solutions.
I guess I will just say, to be a little contrarian here, after the first answer, we have to realize, obviously, the highway building era had some real problems in terms of building through neighborhoods. I mean, there's a situation in Atlanta where there's a highway that actually takes a curve when going straight would have been the cheaper and more direct route because they were trying to separate the low-income minority from the central business district. That's a pretty awful policy, and we certainly want to find ways that we don't do that in anything, really, again. And I think looking at the overall costs, you know, in some ways, the federal government can actually be a problem here, because to the extent that it is incentivizing certain policies, when it was incentivizing highway construction with a large federal share, cities were sort of doing, and states were doing, what the policy designed them to do, which is build roadways, even if it wasn't necessarily to logical places, or it wasn't the cheapest place, because there was that incentive there. And so we have to make sure we're tapping the right federal incentives. But I will say, we don't want to forget that highways and roads in general move the vast majority of folks, certainly lower in cities and certainly lower in D.C. and New York than in other places around the country. But even if the automated vehicles are shared, they are still going to be on roadways, and we have to make sure we have sufficient capacity for that.
I think to add to these points, I'd also say that and I'm sure this has been covered in depth through the day. Sorry I couldn't be here earlier. But that we have the opportunity today to just rethink what a vehicle looks like as well. And many of you in the room are engaged with that. And so we have that choice to think about wheelchair accessible, service animals. How are we going to build vehicles to allow for that level of access for all? But I think the point also goes back towards, is there political will? Is there general will? What is our mindset around these topics?
And on the subject of like political will, I think that, and I'm going to go a little philosophical on this, but I think that part of like demonstrating political will is also the ability to sort of step back and to say that like you don't make infrastructure equitable. You start with equity, and then you would sort of underline or sort of think through, well, what is it that you even want to achieve in the first place, or do you need that infrastructure to make that connection? And sort of like you start with that equity goal, and then you're finding ways of moving people around rather than just being like, well, we need to build a bunch of roads because we need AVs. Oh, by the way, we need to incorporate equity as a part of that. I think it's just like a philosophical reorientation.
I think that's what I was trying to get at with that first question also of, you know, what are the problems that we're trying to solve? And we figure that out first and then figure out how AVs can help solve those problems rather than say, they're coming. What do we do? I wanted to ask, maybe at the risk of fixating too much on Tesla, you know, Tesla's had several high-profile fatalities. Uber, obviously, the self-driving car that hit a pedestrian last March. How have these very high-profile, and understanding that, you know, we have 37,000 deaths on our roadways every year, but these get a lot of attention. How do these incidents change or impact the approach that cities are taking to these cities or states are taking to regulating or embracing driverless technology? Start with you, Beth.
I want to look at this first from a little bit of a different angle, because we heard earlier today about how the OEMs are responding to this as well. I think what this is doing is this is raising significant awareness that this is not as basic and as simple as many thought. I mean, when you're trying to replicate the human mind and the decisions that are being made that way, it's very complicated. So actually in talking to some of these OEMs, they have pulled back and they have really intensified their testing processes. Some of them have their own tracks, in fact, and they're putting them through much more rigorous testing. And one of the things that I think is recognized, we actually did a national survey that dealt with a number of items, including public acceptance. So we found out that 52% of the people that we surveyed with the national sample pool actually believe that the greatest benefit from all of this is increased mobility for non-drivers. So that's a number one benefit, and then safety is second. But how the public actually responds, whatever their first experience is with an autonomous vehicle or any of these other modes that we're talking about, is going to really shape things. So just like we heard earlier, if there is a fatality with an AV that's being tested on a road, that's going to affect the whole industry. So there's pullback on that side. I think we're seeing a little bit more patience within our communities and on the public sector side and appreciation of that.
So I would say, to directly answer your question, I hope they don't. Because I know it's easy to look at something like the Uber crash and say, boy, this is a dangerous technology and we shouldn't do it. But as has been was pointed out in the last panel, 37,000 lives a year is a lot of people that die. And even if automated vehicles are able to reduce that by 50%, that is still a tremendous improvement. Now, I don't. We all hear the statistic, I guess it's 94% of crashes are caused by humans, and the reality is that while a lot of those will be gotten rid of, probably not all of them, and AVs may introduce some new crashes, so I don't want to be too Pollyanna here on the options, but I do think a 50% improvement is better. And I do think it would be helpful if there was some federal the legislation, the Self-Drive Act, I happen to think it was a good bill. It wasn't perfect. Now, I can say there were folks on both sides of the spectrum, folks who thought it went too far, and also someone who's worked on AVs for a while, whose name I will withhold, that said it thought it was an abomination. That being said, passing legislation is very challenging, and I think it would be a good start because the federal government is the one that has traditionally done with safety, whereas the states do with licensing. And I think if we introduce new dynamics where states and local governments are specifically looking at the safety of vehicles, I think that's problematic for a lot of reasons, including the number of different modifications that the OEMs would need to make to vehicles.
I think just adding to that, to the good point that you were making, you look at the number of deaths that are, or accidents that have taken place with AVs, and that's in the, well, you can count them on your hands, or one hand. You look at the number that are caused by, when you're on a cycle or on a scooter, and then you sort of, like in scooters, you're probably getting to around the tens, and then cycles, and cars and pedestrians goes up a lot higher. And it's always interesting to see the uproar that's caused by the one or the two versus just the complacency with the everyday. But aside from that, I think that it's also interesting. I can't speak for Tesla, but I think it's interesting with some of these other new mobility companies like Uber and Lyft about how they're becoming not a ride-hailing company, but a platform company, right? So aside just from the new modes that they're bringing into their platform and the new modes that they're trying to invent, it's also the one-stop shop for you to get your information and make your travel decisions, to make your purchases for transport as well. And I think that when companies start thinking in that sort of holistic way about the entire transport ecosystem, that starts to position them, or I'm hoping that starts to position them differently in the minds of people rather than honing in on only like that one accident that took place. Not to minimize any death, but I think that sort of thing is taken out of context, out of proportion.
I want to ask also, and Baruch, we'll start with you, because I want to ask about federal regulation. Obviously, a lot of people think that the bad PR that goes along with a fatality is enough incentive for OEMs, for AV developers, to wait until the technology is ready. And like you said, when is it ready is an open question, because, even if they're going to improve things, but it's not, they haven't worked out all the kinks, if they're going to make it 50% safer, maybe it's ready. Putting that aside, a lot of people also look at it and say, when we're looking at corporate accountability, we also have Takata airbags, we also have VW emissions cheating. We rely solely on corporate self-policing. Is there a role for the federal government to sign off on these vehicles before? And I realize that this is something that no one in the federal government seems to have much appetite for. But I think that when we see the kind of reservations that the public has about this, maybe it's a conversation worth having.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And couple thoughts. There are some, obviously the state of California requires certain things that the automakers have to do, and many of them are in fact testing there. And there is the self-certification platform where the automakers do have to show that their vehicles are testing, and the federal government does have to approve that. So there's a little bit of that. And should there be more? And I guess I would say not at this time. And there's a couple reasons for that. So first of all, the Uber crash was awful. And I think nobody was more upset with it than me. And the reason I was upset with it is because I really believe that these companies have a responsibility to put safe products on the road. And clearly that's not what was going on. This Uber vehicle was clearly not ready for prime time. The good news is I think the market and also the state of Arizona punished them for that action that I think was honestly a far more punishment than they would have gotten from the federal government if that was the only thing they could have gotten. And the other challenge goes back to your part of your question, which is, does the federal government know when these vehicles are safe enough? How do you prove that? How do you weigh the cost benefit of potentially a loss of life here versus getting the car on the road sooner and doing the loss of life there? I don't know. It's hard to say. I don't have confidence that the government would have enough information to actually weigh that correctly.
No one wants to argue with Bruce on that.
All right. The Senate is about to mark up their 5-year reauthorization bill. And getting back to infrastructure, Derek Kahn said infrastructure is not an enabler, but potentially a blocker, that it is something that can get in the way of the deployment of autonomous vehicles, though it can't necessarily kind of conjure them. If we're about to set policy for the next 5 years of highway policy in the United States, what should the Senate, what should Congress be looking at now that in the next 5 years will need to happen?
Well, they might be able to look at what the state of Florida is doing, in fact. I know I keep going back to that, and I promised I would.
Okay, I keep going back to Tesla.
But actually, if you take a look what Flora is doing, now legislation has been enacted and projects are being sought to actually embed the technology in new infrastructure. So when we're looking at long-range planning, this is something that should be a part of that. And, you know, we've talked a lot about the life-saving elements of this. Well, if we're really going to be serious about it, we're going to start including these things in our long-range planning, including things that have to do with the electrification of vehicles and expecting those on our roadways, for example. So in looking at long-range transportation plans, how do you address that? And if that's the way the automobiles are going for various reasons, and you have to ensure that the infrastructure can support that, you have to find ways to start being forward-thinking about how do you handle things such as hurricanes that we heard before under those circumstances. So these are some things that can be looked at in transportation planning. Also, we had a discussion about 5.9 gig that happened earlier. What kind of leadership role can the Senate play in that to ensure safety over the long term and what have you?
So I would say there's currently grant programs right now for a lot of the smart infrastructure that I know Beth has been talking about, and I think those are important, and I think those should continue. That's obviously separate from the 6-year authorization bill, but I still think that's important. I also think there's value in the so-called dumb infrastructure, which is maintaining your roadways, making sure your lines are painted. And Kirk Steudle, who was former Michigan DOT secretary, brought up a good point, which is that, well, if you're in a cold weather place, your lines and your roadway pavement can get chipped pretty badly in the winter. So I think we need to look at some sort of partnership, possibly public-private partnership, where state DOTs are going out and making sure that the maintenance for the self-driving vehicles is actually there. And that's not necessarily just the pavement, but it could also be if there's vehicle-to-vehicle. I'm personally more of a fan of cellular V2X than I am of DSRC. I think that's kind of what we'll see where that goes. But I think that is really important, and that has the advantage of not only helping automated vehicles, but also helping today's vehicles and transit vehicles, and so shouldn't be challenging from a political perspective.
And just to add on a little bit about, you know, like targeting like dumb infrastructure or like taking more of like a nuts and bolts approach. But I do think that there's a degree of to which that you can sort of write in some degree of prioritization around specific, it could be a freight pinch point. It could be particular areas where spending money matters. And so a lot of states have done this in terms of like right-sizing infrastructure projects and thinking about, well, what is currently in the pipeline and do you actually need the $90 million project or could you accomplish 98% of it with a $9 million project? And so I think that there's ways of sort of building in that philosophy of prioritization and then right-sizing into how the actual reauthorization is structured.
I'll just pick up on the point that Beth was making about hurricanes, and I'm wondering what the opportunity is to look at funding resilient infrastructure in cities and marrying that with the recreation of transport infrastructure that's needed as well. And I think that that there are there's common cause with a lot of these sort of new mobility platform companies that are looking at streets that are slower, that are looking at rethinking sort of street allocation, and I think that bringing some of these moving parts together can actually sort of spur that forward.
I've been sitting here trying to think whether I want to go down the rabbit hole of 5.9 gigahertz that you brought up, Baruch, and let's go there for a minute. So the FCC is still kind of in this decision-making process about whether to reserve this kind of safety band for vehicle-to-vehicle or vehicle-to-infrastructure transportation communications. It's very underused right now. There's also this kind of raging debate about what is the right, maybe it's not even raging anymore, maybe it's settled, that the original DSRC technology that the federal government had sort of chosen is not the right one. DOT now wants to be tech neutral, and aside from that, most of industry has embraced a new technology. So right now, DOT has just chosen to stay out of it. They're not... They have kind of frozen rulemaking on that. Is that the most helpful thing for them to do, to just stop? Or do they need to, at some point, just say, this is the policy and move forward? Because it does seem like this limbo is more harmful than having new policy.
So the answer to your question is yes. For the time being, I would say, because I don't think it's settled, that they should stay out of it. But yes, at a certain point in time, and of course I wish I could tell you when that time is, and I don't know, we do need to choose a technology because we can't just go on this forever. I think the rationale for staying out of it right now is that as it stands currently, DSRC would be more effective because 5G V2X is not ready for prime time. But many people expect that within a few years, 5G with V2X is going to be the better technology. But because, of course, we can't predict the future and we don't know, I think we shouldn't be making a decision just yet. And there are, I don't want to trash DSRC because there are advantages of DSRC. Europe is doing a lot with it. It's just when I look at the 5G vs DSRC, DSRC is going to require a lot of government funding and spending. And at a time when, honestly, we don't really do a good job of maintaining our roads, sort of the classic, I just don't see the political support there. I really don't. It could be a great technology in a laboratory, but in the real world, I have some concerns. And I think with 5G and V2X, you can get the private sector to pick up a lot of those costs, and it's a benefit. I would say I am generally supportive of keeping the wireless spectrum in the DOT. Now, I do think at a certain point in time, we need to show in the transportation sector that we're really going to make good use of it, because obviously there's competing demands right now. But I'm not just willing to cede it to the FCC because it hasn't been used yet. But I do think we need to make some progress there.
Anyone else want to weigh in on this? Okay, that was long enough of that radical.
I'm curious also about sort of the role of the private sector And partly in some of the infrastructure upgrades, perhaps electrification upgrades, that need to happen to prepare for the autonomous era. You know, is that something that the federal government should be doing, or is that something that the private sector, that these companies need to do themselves if they want to roll out, for example, electric vehicles, that they should be in charge of figuring out how to also roll out electric vehicle charging stations? Is that, whose job is that?
Well, I don't know that it's limiting that it has to be the private sector or the public sector. I think it can also be partnerships between the private sector and public sector. It's just like we were talking about before. There are certain conditions and situations that for electric vehicles and electric charging stations, if those are going to be installed and you have a significant amount of your population dependent on that, then you have to make sure that you have a resilient infrastructure that can accommodate that. So when it comes to the overall resiliency and safety, that's usually something that is a public sector responsibility. But I think you can work very closely in partnership with the private sector, because there are definitely some benefits, even benefits from the standpoint of if you're implementing infrastructure that includes sensing technology and data collection technology and whatnot. That data that's collected can be very valuable also to the private sector. And that goes to a whole other discussion about data generation, data sharing, you know, who owns it, that sort of thing. But I'm not so sure that that is a singular answer. I think there can be a tremendous amount of partnership in that.
And I think inherently it almost has to be a partnership. Charging, like fast charging a Class 8 tractor trailer essentially requires the same amount of energy that's used in a single day to power a Walmart. So like, even if you were going to have a fleet of Class A trucks, right, like you sort of need exponential demand that you're putting on the power grid, which would seem to imply that if like, let's say my former employer UPS wanted to roll out a bunch of trucks, we might need to coordinate with the utility and you know, the city and others to sort of create an environment that's actually conducive to us doing that. And so I think that there's a lot of interplay and potential to work hand in hand to bring different technologies online and sort of, you know, structure rates appropriately and just provide that infrastructure where necessary.
Yeah, in theory, the private sector should do it, but I see nothing wrong with public-private partnerships along the lines that those just mentioned. I think those are a win-win, and I think those are a great way to get it done.
That's an interesting question, and I was thinking back to two examples. One was Bird's announcement to allocate $1 billion last year. They made that announcement towards the creation of bicycle lane infrastructure in cities. I'm sure a lot of you remember that, and then how, I think, 6 months later, if I remember correctly, that program was closed. And not to point out Bird in particular, but I think that there is skepticism and maybe healthy skepticism when private sector is pushing for some of these infrastructure changes. But then on the other hand, you know, you read cases about how some of these new mobility companies are working with local communities that have been historically neglected in terms of transit investment, and how they're working at quite a grassroots level to help bring infrastructure, whether it's the docked bicycles or other types of infrastructure, into those communities. So I think that that you're right. It is it's probably not a straightforward or an easy answer, and it does have to come through coordination and through partnerships.
I think it's important that folks get out and experience the technology. One of the things we've seen is if you ask a survey of people and what they think of autonomous technology, most folks are usually negative, and they're negative because what gets the coverage is what happened in Arizona, as opposed to the number of successful rides that another one does, because that's really not very interesting or newsworthy. But we find that when folks actually ride in these vehicles and find that they're, you know, not altogether different from today's vehicles, and they're not taking them around corners at 50 miles an hour and crashing them into other vehicles, they become much more supportive. So I think the pilots can sort of build on themselves, and I think it's important that the pilots go to different places in the city, not just one select. I know oftentimes it can be easier just to geofence it and put it in one place to start, and I think that makes sense. And obviously, many of these vehicles are what they call level 4 on the Society of Automotive Engineers scale. They're not going to be everywhere, but moving them around to different neighborhoods to increase support, I think, is really important.
And I'll just add to what Baruch said. I completely agree with that. And also to have those sustainable, when I say sustainable, I'm not necessarily talking about environmental, I mean sustainable from a longevity standpoint, those sustainable pilots are really important for information sharing. Just as I said before, there's a lot for both parties to learn when you do that, and then the public engagement is very, very important. Even if you look at some of our communities, those that are 65 and older, and as you get to a point where maybe you lose your ability to be independent and you rely on others for mobility, when you can start to expose those members of our cities and our states in the technology and they can experience it, it definitely helps with public acceptance and trust. And that is probably one of the biggest factors that will either enhance or impede rolling this out. So I completely agree with what Baruch said.
I'd add and say that in addition to these pilots or in conjunction with these pilots, that I'm hoping that there is robust discussion around what are the goals that those cities are trying to achieve. So not just simply procuring a widget, but rather thinking about what is the challenge and what is the solution that they're hoping to experiment around. I'd also say that it's important to sort of think about the current mix of modes in that city and not only where the goals of that city are, but what does this look like in a city like D.C. where 40% of the population don't have cars versus other cities in the U.S. where 10% of the population don't have cars?
Just really quickly, from a pilot perspective and making it actually last well into the future, I think we also sometimes have a tendency to want I think the idealized version of autonomous vehicles to be what's piloted rather than what is perhaps very practical in the short term and very executable on a repeating basis. And so if you look at things like some of the and it's not true like full AV, of course, but like automation at ports, very implementable, achievable, repeatable. And can be scaled to different places. And then I think that doing things like that also builds slow acceptance over time of increasing automation, that it doesn't just have to be like immediately you will be able to go everywhere in an autonomous Uber.
Jyot, I also want to open some space. You, Numo works at a global level. You just moved back from India. I would just love to hear what you're seeing around the world, where we've been focusing a lot on the United States and kind of what you're seeing around the world as places are beginning to wrestle with this new emerging technology.
Thanks. I think in the global south, the rise that we're seeing of ride hailing has been very interesting, especially where the entire population doesn't have access to formalized banking products or even sometimes internet access on their phones. I think mobile phone penetration is quite good in cities in the global south at this point. And so it's interesting to see these new products that are coming out, and I'd love to see some of those being tested over here as well for unbanked populations. So that's one piece. There's, I think, a very big question around how to regulate those models. But I think maybe the base... the entry point of this discussion is fundamentally different from the entry point of this discussion in the U.S., which is that the majority of trips, for example, in a city like Bombay, are done by walking. 50% of trips is walking. Then of the motorized, another 50% is public transport. And so you get down to about like 8 maybe or 10% of trips that are being made by car. And so in an ecosystem like that, where these cities are undergoing massive change, just new populations coming into the city, you know, a lot of growth potential, a lot of, you know, many aspirations for people to enter the middle class, where a vehicle has been that that traditional way to show that you have entered the middle class, you know, I think that there are very big questions about, well, are these new models sort of substituting for people wanting to own their own vehicle? Or is it actually shifting how people think about moving around? But also fundamentally, the capacity of cities in the global south is a lot lower to be able to deal with a lot of these changes. So, you know, the handoff of what would be done by the public sector and the private sector, I think, is a bit more stark over there. Aside from that slightly depressing story, I think that there are also just really exciting things happening around how we think about informal transit and paratransit in African cities, in Indian cities, data standards that are being developed off of those, how we're thinking about utilizing motorcycles as taxis as well, very large operations of those emerging. So there's a lot of innovation that's taking place, but I would say just fundamentally it looks a bit different than what's happening in the U.S. because of that mix, which is very different, and the affordability, which is very different.
I'm kind of reeling from the mode share that you just described in India. I mean, 50% walking, 8% single occupancy vehicle. If those even were single occupancy, is just so opposite from where we are. And Baruch, you also mentioned how autonomous technology can be helpful in transit. I think that there's a lot of concern that autonomous technology, like TNCs, can increase congestion, because if taking your own door-to-door vehicle is the cheapest, most efficient, most accessible way, then what are the incentives not to do that? So I would love to hear more about how autonomous technology is going to get us closer to 50% walking and 8% single occupancy vehicle, and is going to actually help the transit sector instead of rendering it obsolete.
Sure. Well, I don't think we're ever going to get to 50% walking in those modes, except
that's
maybe
sort of a joke,
New York City. Yeah, right. Okay. Well, just didn't want to get anyone's hopes up for that. So first of all, as I think I mentioned, I really believe pricing is the key. There's been a lot looked at urban growth boundaries, changing land use, and all of that can work in certain situations. But what we found is that what folks are most sensitive to is cost. That's what makes them change their mind. They're not, at least by and large, sensitive to nice societal goals as much as we might want them to. Folks generally tend to be kind of selfish. Sorry for that downer. That's just kind of the reality. So I think that's important. I would also say we may need to change our mind on what we consider transit. Certainly in core DC, in core New York, the heavy rail lines are never going away. But in a lot of places where we have bus, I'm a big fan of BRT. Sometimes I even look at BRT. That may not be the future. The future may be smaller vehicles. The future may be, in fact, cars where we actually have four people in them as opposed to 1.1 people in them, which is basically what we have now. And I think transit agencies and everyone really has to look at how they can work together. One of the challenges is we've been doing transit for basically the same way for the last 50 years, and ridership is going down, and we're not real good at change because it's hard. And I'm hopeful that automated vehicles and some of these new technologies will be the impetus for folks to actually step out of their box. And we are seeing Jacksonville Transit Agency is actually doing some interesting things. They're testing some AVs instead of their, I think they had a people mover system. So some transit agencies are looking at new technologies, which is encouraging.
I will add a little to that and just say that there's still only, especially as you go into a city, there's only so much physical real estate. And so it's at some point you're sort of just talking about if, you know, you can fit X number of people on a bus, X number of people in a transit line, X number of people in an automated car, like you sort of are still sort of stuck with some of those limitations. And so I think that interplay of available real estate, how that real estate is actually used and thought about as a city, like how are you building this infrastructure to facilitate cars? Are you aiming to facilitate more walking? And the levers that you're pulling as a city plays a role in ultimately whether AVs, you know, cause a decline in transit use or actually somehow play a role in encouraging it.
I'm going to talk about curb space too. Tom, you have a unique take on this as both an urban bicyclist and a UPS driver. Curb space is becoming very crowded with Ubers and Lyfts, with bike lanes. There's just increasing competition, and it's becoming more of an issue. There have been pilot programs trying to deal with this. Just kind of wanted to hear what we've learned about how to manage curb space in a place where people are less kind of driving their own car and parking it and more being picked up and let off.
In case this hasn't come through yet, I tend to like often like take steps back from questions and then like think about it philosophically and then sort of go from there. So like my take on this, and I had the luxury and continue to have the luxury of talking with a lot of different DOT officials all across the country, thinking about, you know, what do you actually want to achieve? What are your goals? How do you want your city to work and function? And so I just like straight up asked them, like, what are your transportation priorities? If you just listed them out, and by and large, and rarely have this ever deviated, the answers I get back are that they care most about safety, they care about equity, they care about shared mobility, they care about like basically making sure that their businesses stay in business and they continue to have economic development, and then they mention single occupancy personal vehicles. And then I asked them, well, then why does every street in America look the exact opposite, right? That there's personal vehicle parking, there's probably one loading zone, there's no bus lane, or like there's some other, you know, impediment to that. I'm going to die crossing the street, and nothing is equitable. So like the orientation of the curb, and when I think about curb, it's a political decision ultimately, and it's like demonstrating political will to say like, well, your curb doesn't have to look that way. Doesn't have to be, five metered spaces that collect like a dollar in an hour or something like that. You could blow up the curb entirely. Actually, I think that DC's DOT is actually very progressive in this. One of the pilots that UPS, in conjunction with a startup called CurbFlow, launched and just launched actually in DC, is to really think about like, well, if you could take like the 8 or 9. Different spaces in a city that were particularly congested, contributing to a lot of double truck parking, places like the Wharf, if anybody's been down there, where it's really just not easy to get around, partially also because of Uber and Lyft drop up, and just say, you know, do we actually need that parking space, or do we just turn that entire curb into a giant flex zone, essentially? And eventually, I think the idea and the connection back to autonomous vehicles here is that as you start to think about available curb space at designated times, you can integrate that with whatever from an autonomous vehicle perspective so that you know when vehicles are going to arrive, you have available curb space for them, they're able to use that and then, you know, get on their way and move, you know, and sort of better manage that curb use accordingly. But I think the ultimate thing, right, is like that you don't need to do things the way that you do things today.
Yeah, I will say that like a lot of these issues, this is not necessarily new. It's just being maybe exacerbated by automated vehicles. I mean, we have problems today with truck loading and you know, bicycling and walking and all the rest of it. I will say, little plug here, that I think 25 years ago, my boss, Adrian Moore, wrote a book, actually for Brookings, that was called Managing Curb Space. And it's kind of cycling back around again. And not surprising, pricing has a big part to do with it, and who you're going to price and how you're going to do it. And to Tom's point, making sure that you're having all of the various users come in there. I think very often cities don't necessarily consider the freight and the private delivery. I mean, we see this a lot with designing streets, and you know, you want to narrow streets because you want to encourage certain uses, which is great. But if your freight trucks can't get in there and make deliveries, that's kind of a problem. So making sure you have the cyclists, the walker, the freight delivery, the people who are going to drive their cars, the Uber, Lyft, taxis, all those folks involved, I think is important.
I want to go to the audience for questions. Does anybody have... Oh, good. Yes.
I wanted to take the advantage of Tom here to talk about freight. And since you're from the Grocery Manufacturers Association especially, because one of the things... I learned about freight is that the actual delivery driver oftentimes stocks the shelves. So there's this connection that we don't, there's a sort of first mile, last mile between the wholesale and the retail and freight. So from your perspective of logistics and groceries, that's what you're, you know, what are they excited about? What are they skeptical at? What are they rolling their eyes at? What do they think are the big problems? What can you give us a sort of insight into your industry and this automated vehicles space?
And so I'll just to sort of provide some background or context, GMA predominantly represents America's sort of favorite brands that make consumer packaged goods. It could be anybody from PepsiCo to Coca-Cola to Procter & Gamble. So there's a diversity of products, not just food items, but also like razor blades and soap. So that accounts for 1/5 of U.S. freight. Most of the companies in that space rely on external service providers or paying for transportation. They're not ultimately the ones that have their own fleet. PepsiCo is like a sort of its own beast entirely, and they have their own. But because of that, there's a great deal of beholdenness, I think, to an industry that also ATA came out with their sort of annual report yesterday talking about a truck driver shortage, that, you know, there's 60,000 fewer truck drivers today than are needed, and then that number will more than double over the next decade. And so I think that from our industry's perspective, as you look to automated vehicles, there's, I think, a hope and a promise just from a purely sort of efficiency perspective, from like a how do you sort of rethink supply chains, and you're talking about a technology that sort of fundamentally can, you know, you take something that today takes 5 days in a truck because of hours of service and things like that, and it condenses, you know, 5 day trip across the country to 2 days or even less. So you open up sort of this Pandora's box of questions, like, well, could you just completely change your network configurations for supply chains? Could you dramatically sort of change how you do business? From a driver side, I also don't think that we talk about autonomous vehicles. What sometimes gets lost in that, and especially around truck driving and like the commercial side of things, is that like there's this assumption that the truck driver just goes away. And frankly, I think that that's missing the boat somewhat, because oftentimes that driver, and this is especially the case when I was at UPS, that driver is either the face of your company or they have many other roles to play, sort of to your point about either stocking shelves or interacting as a receiving capacity, a customer service capacity. And so I think that there's a real interest in figuring out how do you couple that technology that can improve safety and efficiency with then somehow enabling that driver to do more and to provide them with additional skills and training as they go about their work.
Other questions? Yes.
This is about regulation. I know FDA, for example, regulates all the pharma companies, right? they don't want a pharma company to put a drug in the market before they go through the proper trials. I think it was mentioned that you don't need the federal government to regulate autonomous cars, but suppose I open a 20-person company and say, okay, you know, I'm going to go ahead with autonomous cars because I just buy cars from, say, Honda or Toyota and add my own LiDAR technology and put it in the market. Should the government allow me to do that?
So let me just make sure I understand. So basically what you're saying is, should the government allow aftermarket technologies to be placed on the car? I mean, or
for that matter, allow anybody to put a car out in the market just because they can self-regulate themselves?
Well, I guess I would say, so there's certain standards that vehicles have to submit to today in order to be certified. There is a self-certification process. So I wouldn't say it's true that right now you can put any technology out on the market, and I don't think we'd want to introduce that. Part of me likes the entrepreneurial aspect of that, but part of me also realizes there's a safety component as well. I think the process we have today works well. It's a little different than how they do it in Europe because it's generally not super onerous for the company, and so that allows smaller startups to do it. But there is a little, well, there's more than a little bit. There's a safety component of it to make sure what's put out there isn't going to kill people.
Other questions? Yes? I knew if I waited long enough, somebody would have one.
I'm still not sure how the technology will affect the entire population. Technology always coming with a cost. So just I'm thinking about the kind of a case. There's somebody who is making $15 per hour and have two children and have to commute somewhere and also have to pick up child on the way back and also have to go to grocery shopping. For that kind of person, for that person will benefit or not benefit, how much she or he has to pay more or pay less?
Are you assuming that autonomous vehicles will be introduced as shared fleets like Uber, as opposed to private car ownership?
Uber or ownership or whatever. What kind of option is available for that person? How much does it cost? Does it really help? Or does it raise her or his expenditure?
Mm-hmm. I feel that question. Busy people making multiple trips. What's the best way to do that? I'm sorry? Right.
Yeah. So that's a tough question. Okay. So when we're looking at technology, at least my approach is I'm looking if there's overall societal gain. Are some people going to lose and some people going to win? Probably in just about everything in life. Like trying to make everything better for everybody is pretty challenging. But I do think if you look at the shared model, which seems to be how most people think AVs are going to roll out, at least for early. And I personally do think there's going to be individuals owning AVs, and probably more than we think, but that certainly does not need to be the model for everybody. And I think if you look at the shared model, because the costs of vehicle ownership are so much less, and the vehicles might not even be owed by folks using them, they might actually be some sort of lease, there may be companies that are actually using them, I think that that is going to have a significantly lower economic cost, at least over the long run. Now, the challenge you bring up is how about folks that need to make trips during the day? Are the vehicles going to be available to them? And that's challenging. That's one of the questions folks are looking at with these shared vehicles is if everyone leaves work at 5 o'clock, are there going to be enough vehicles and how do you guarantee that? And I honestly think that's a little bit tricky. I think that's one of the reasons individually owned vehicles will be available. But I do think there is a lot more potential, and there's also, we have programs right now that are used if folks, for example, take transit one way, but the transit doesn't operate back, or they're in van pools, which are where 7 to 14 people share a ride, things called guaranteed ride home, where there's a way to get home or get someplace if they need to. So I think we can expand those type of things. I think we can make it work. I'm not saying we've got it solved right now, but I think it's a very promising technology, and I do think it can make driving more affordable for folks.
People can all leaving work.
Add something to that.
Sorry. Sure, of course.
I think your question is prompting me to think about an inclusive design process, and I think the private sector is much better at this sometimes. but when you look at how a lot of transit options or how cities are planned, I think that the trips that you're mentioning are not at the forefront for planning those systems. And so I very much agree with you that design process needs to be much more inclusive if we're really going to, you know, push for transport that is accessible and useful for all.
I think that gets to the point also of, you know, what if we put equity first and framed all of this as we're trying to solve a problem of equity. We can add on top of that also congestion. We can add on top of it mobility, and then what is the best way for that, you know, parent of two working a $15 an hour job to get around. I also wanted to get back to Baruch's point about the, you know, everyone leaving at 5 o'clock. Will there be enough vehicles? I mean, that's a nightmare now. You know, that is a failure of our transportation system and a failure of our ability to work around it. I mean, you know, that's a, you know, if people just had more staggered work times, so many of our transportation problems could be solved.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, and we've tried things. I mean, we've obviously tried to incentivize carpooling to get folks to carpool, and it's a little better in the D.C. region because the congestion is so bad. But by and large, we've not been super successful. I, as someone who gets to work from home a lot, don't understand why folks aren't willing to go in an hour earlier or stay an hour later to avoid the peak congestion. And I know it's sometimes not that easy. You've got to pick a child up from daycare, whatever. But again, not to be a broken record, but I think looking at pricing, I mean, taking the I-66 lanes, for those of you who are local and familiar with that. Now, the ones in the morning are a bit of a challenge, and it has to do with some geometric design issues where you've got to merge from four lanes to two lanes and also getting into D.C. So, okay. But the ones in the afternoon, I still support them, by the way. Happy to talk to you about why. The ones in the afternoon, though, are really wonderful. And if you look at it, a relatively minor price of, maybe 50 to 75 cents per mile has basically gotten rid of all of the congestion on I-66 westbound, going from D.C. out to Fairfax County, where I live. And it's actually kind of amazing because it's really not that much in the context of D.C. And honestly, a lot of the incomes here are fairly high, not all of them, but some of them. And the biggest problem is what happens when the pricing ends and you have congestion before and after, because everyone is trying to avoid paying the price, which I totally get. But if you priced it 24/7, you would not have this problem. So there's a lot we can do with policy. I realize the political acceptance is very, very challenging. But we can't, to your point, we can solve these problems if we really want to, I think.
Any other questions from the audience? Yes.
Thank you. Hi, I'm an urban planning student interning at the Federal Highway Administration who comes from a really rural part of the country. And while we have talked today a lot about these issues in urban places, it has also been alluded to that this too may change the form in rural areas. And so I'm just curious, from your broad range of expertise and perspectives here, how you guys see this playing out in more rural areas in the U.S.?
It's going to be different. And I guess one of the questions is my mind is, will there be enough folks going to similar locations where the ride sharing is going to work, or is it going to be more individually owned vehicles? I mean, it's definitely going to be more individually owned. That's just reality. And obviously, there's been some talk of electrification, and I do think Tesla says a lot of stuff, but their success with the Model 3 in terms of the demand and also producing it makes me fairly optimistic for electrification. So I think that's positive there, assuming the power source, of course. We don't know, is a question. We think for the exurban areas, there's going to be quite a bit of ride sharing. I think for the rural areas, I don't know. Maybe some of the new models can work to improve the transit service in the rural areas, which is, you know, basically non-existent. Or, you know, I mean, you could actually do a lot with dial-a-ride sort of type, but it's going to be very different. And I think you bring up a good point, and I think it's going to come to the urban areas first before it gets to the rural areas. But that's obviously a politically sensitive topic.
With the few seconds that we have left, I just want to ask what your biggest worries are. I don't know if this is a few-second answer. But, you know, as we approach right now with very little regulation, as we approach the advent of the driverless era, what keeps you up at night?
That we, after all of this, that we still end up with a transportation system that is the second highest household expense that results in many deaths, that is a big contributor to emissions.
I have a two-part answer. Not surprisingly, I'm worried more about overregulation, certainly not right now, but in the future. And I also worry that we will not take this opportunity to do things such as congestion pricing that could be a big benefit.
One of the things that I do think about has to do with funding, funding of overall transportation infrastructure, especially when we're going with the electrification of vehicles. And I think we have a great opportunity here because we're talking about a lot of innovation. And as we're talking about innovation and also as we might be moving towards shared mobility and whatnot, we should really look innovatively as to how we actually fund infrastructure. It's been challenging, particularly because we have states that do their own level of funding, and then we have the federal government that's also responsible for funding. So as states are experimenting in different strategies to be innovative, we also have the federal government who covers the sphere of the entire country, and we could have the ability of different methods being used in different places, and that could create challenges for us.
I wish I could tell you that, like, political decisions were made just on the basis of fact and, like, complete logic and, like, that was... So I think that my fear is that sort of, like, political realities and the sort of, you know, the desire of people to appease other people gets in the way of some of the decisions that are crucially needed. It could be to Baruch's point about congestion pricing or some other, you know, mechanisms of changing transportation. But it can also be about just like the way that things are rolled out. And so if it's more politically viable in the short term to have a personal vehicle regulatory approach for autonomous vehicles rather than commercial applications, which I actually, and this may be just, you know, yes, I represent GMA, but I think that there's more viable short-term options for commercial autonomy than there are for personal autonomy. But that's not a politically viable thing necessarily to say. And so I think that the sensitivity there would have to be that just that you don't let politics get in the way of actual progress.
Well, that does it for us. Please join me in thanking the panel for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you very much for attending, and thank you to all the panelists. I had two requests for you. One is if you have any trash around your seats or from your snacks, could you please bring it to the back or into the hallway where there's trash cans? The second request is more is to join us for a reception afterward. Right in the hallway, we're going to have some snacks and drinks. So thank you.